As being a master phraseologist himself.
Join me, Susie Dent, as I uncover a remarkable story that transformed our language and learn about the man who sacrificed his life to translate the Bible into everyday English. The Deadliest Book in England. Available to hear now on BBC Sounds.
Good morning, it's 6 o'clock on Thursday, the 27th of August. This is Today with Emma Barnett in London and Anna Foster in Salford.
The headlines this morning. Rescue teams are searching for hundreds of tourists, including dozens of British nationals, who are missing after a devastating flash flood killed more than 160 people in Nepal. And a whistleblower has told the BBC that changes to Meta's social media platforms agreed as part of that US court settlement will not make children safer online.
Also in today's programme, the woman marking her 100th birthday by returning for the first time to the train station where, as a schoolgirl, she was forced to escape the Nazis.
I knew I was going to England, but I didn't know who was going to take care of me. I was frightened. The other thing that frightened me was the fact that the Gestapo were on the platform and patrolling the platform.
And we'll hear from the political novelist Robert Harris on Andy Burnham, Nigel Farage, and the parallels between ancient Rome and the current US president.
When Trump had a gladiator cage fight on the lawn of the White House, I thought the parallels are getting ridiculous. Unlike almost any other American president, you can really see him in a toga with a gold laurel wreath on his head.
The BBC News is read for us this morning by Chris Aldridge.
Rescuers are racing to find the survivors of a massive flash flood and mudslide on the border between Nepal and Tibet. At least 160 people have died in Nepal and more than 800 people are missing, including at least 579 tourists. On the Tibetan side of the border, Chinese media reports indicate that three people have died and more than 500 are unaccounted for. Here's Aruna Iyengar.
Officials describe the destruction as beyond imagination. Entire settlements have been hit, roads and infrastructure ripped apart. CCTV footage at Girong Port near the border between Nepal and China shows residents running for their lives as a wall of mud and debris overwhelmed buildings and tossed cars and lorries aside. Why this devastating flood happened has not been confirmed, but the US Geological Survey said a collapsing glacier had caused what it called catastrophic impacts downstream. This is the worst natural disaster to hit Nepal since an earthquake in 2015, which killed 9,000 people. International tourists are among those missing, including dozens of British nationals. A tour company in Nepal, Alpine EcoTrek, says it has not been able to make contact with a group including 12 Britons who were booked on a walking tour to Mount Kailash in Tibet.
A whistleblower has warned that plans to heavily restrict children's usage of Facebook and Instagram as part of a multi-billion dollar US court settlement by the tech giant Meta won't make young people safer online. Meta has denied any wrongdoing after agreeing its largest payment to date over claims it harmed children. Here's our North America technology correspondent Lily Jamali.
As part of this settlement, Meta is agreeing to make sweeping changes to its apps for users in the U.S. These include placing a two-hour daily limit by default for teenagers across the Meta platforms, Instagram and Facebook, as well as nighttime restrictions. The company is not admitting any wrongdoing as part of the settlement. Meta will also pay states penalties of up to $18 billion, equivalent to more than 13 billion pounds, with the full amount kicking in only if competitors TikTok and Google's YouTube agree to similar changes. But Arturo Bejar, a former Meta safety engineer who was the first witness to testify against the company in the trial, told the BBC that the settlement would not make children safer online.
It allows Meta to define harm. And behind my whistleblowing was this internal knowledge that the harm that the company was reporting publicly was 100 to 400 times less than what the new people were experiencing, especially young people. And the agreement as it stands does not make that better.
Meta still faces significant litigation from multiple U.S. school districts and thousands of individuals who say the company's apps led to harms from depression to suicide.
Two people who died in a house fire in Grangetown near Middlesbrough yesterday have been named as Natalie McDonald and her 7-year-old niece, Valentina Foster. Two men have been arrested on suspicion of murder. The fire happened a few miles from Saturday's fatal car crash, which killed seven people, including two police officers. Police say they're keeping an open mind but are not ruling out possible links to organised crime. Fiona Trott reports.
Bright and bubbly. That's how Natalie McDonald's family described the 34-year-old who got married just 9 months ago. Her 7-year-old niece, Valentina, was described as a cute little girl who hours before the blaze was dancing around the living room making videos. The house fire is about 2 miles from Saturday's fatal car crash. Five men died after colliding with a police car on the A66. Four of them had previous criminal convictions. PC Tom Clough and PC Matthew Blades were also killed.
Police in France say one person was killed when a man drove a car into a crowd in the northwestern city of Caen last night. 10 other people were injured, 7 of them seriously. Reports suggest the incident happened after a fight in a local bar. A 26-year-old suspect has been arrested. A second worker at Frankfurt Airport has died after apparently catching malaria. 4 other members of staff are being treated in hospital after contracting the disease. Health professionals in Germany believe it must have been transmitted by mosquitoes carried on an inbound plane, as Michael Daventry explains.
Malaria is both preventable and curable, but it sometimes goes undiagnosed if a sufferer has not themselves travelled to an affected area. The precise circumstances of the Frankfurt deaths are uncertain. Germany's Robert Koch Institute believes the disease was spread by an imported Anopheles mosquito, but it isn't clear from which country. Frankfurt Airport does have direct flights to destinations where malaria is present, such as sub-Saharan Africa and India. Mosquito traps have now been installed at the airport and those caught will be sent for genetic tests to find out more about their origin.
A memoir by Jason Arday, the Cambridge professor who died after stepping down during a plagiarism row, is going on sale in the UK today. Entitled Great and Unfortunate Things, it was made available in the US earlier this month, just days before his death. The publishers say the decision to release the book in the UK was made with the agreement of Jason Arday's immediate family. The Japanese avant-garde artist Yayoi Kusama, who's known as the Polka Dot Queen, has died aged 97. She's best known for mirror installations, colourful images and decorated pumpkin sculptures, taking inspiration from hallucinations of flashing lights, dots and flowers she had seen since childhood. Instantly recognisable in her bright red wig and bold spotted outfits, Yayoi Kusama achieved huge commercial success in her later years as she worked from a psychiatric hospital in Tokyo, where she lived voluntarily for the second half of her life.
Chris, thank you very much indeed. It's 7 minutes past six. Let's get the latest on the weather, shall we? Let's see what Ben Rich has to say at the BBC Weather Centre for us. Morning, Ben.
Thank you very much, Emma. Morning to you. Quite a lively day of weather lies ahead of us, particularly in England and Wales. Some very heavy downpours, some thunderstorms. They have already arrived across the south of England, South Wales as well. They will push northwards through the day. Could give some localised flooding and some travel disruption. All the while, Northern Ireland and Scotland are quieter day of weather here, more in the way of dry weather and some sunny spells. So let's start off across the southwest of England, the southeast of England. Here, some showers and thunderstorms have arrived through the early hours. They will continue over the next couple of hours, bringing a lot of rain in a short space of time in some locations, some squally winds, maybe some hail thrown in for good measure. But the rain should push northwards pretty quickly through the morning. Then things will brighten up. There'll be some sunshine, just one or two scattered heavy showers and thunderstorms into the afternoon. For Wales, the Midlands, eastern England, those showers and thunderstorms are already arriving from the south. They will become more widespread through the morning and then into the afternoon. Things dry out. We'll see some sunny spells, but again, some scattered thunderstorms here and there. For northern England, it's a bit of a misty and murky start in places, quite a humid start as well. We'll be largely dry for the first part of the morning, but late morning into the afternoon, cloud and heavy rain will spread from the south with some flashes of lightning, some rumbles of thunder. For Northern Ireland and for Scotland, a bit of a misty start in places, but a lot of dry weather, some sunny spells. Some rain will push into southern parts of Scotland and maybe southern counties of Northern Ireland later in the day, and temperatures north to south, 17 to 25 degrees.
Thank you, Ben. Let's take a first look at the front pages of the morning papers at 6:09. And the front page of The Times charts the destruction at the Nepal-Tibet border with images of people running for their lives as a huge wall of mud, water and debris engulfs a building. The Daily Mail describes that disaster as an apocalyptic mudslide that wiped out everything in its path. We will, of course, be reporting from there for you this morning. The paper says that witnesses thought they were seeing explosions caused by a military invasion as clouds of debris were thrown up into the air.
The I newspaper leads on Meta's decision to pay billions of dollars to settle claims, which it denies, that Facebook and Instagram harm children. The paper notes the firm's agreement to make apps safer for young people will not apply to the UK. The Guardian's analysis calls the introduction of default protections for teens a major concession that sets a precedent others in the tech industry are likely to follow. Well, that's told him, quips the Sun columnist Colin Robertson, who points out that the cost of the settlement represents just over 1% of Meta's $1.4 trillion value.
The Daily Telegraph says it understands that Germany is in talks to invest in Britain's nuclear deterrent as part of efforts to reduce Europe's reliance on the United States. The paper says military planners in Berlin believe they could contribute air defences to key locations, such as the base in Faslane in Scotland that houses submarines armed with the UK's Trident missiles.
Andy Burnham has spoken to the Financial Times in what it describes as his most pro-business interview since becoming Prime Minister. He tells the FT he's acutely conscious of how hard the operating environment is for business, but declines to say whether taxes on companies would rise in the upcoming budget.
And the coverage of the outpouring of affection and love for the late Queen of Country, Dolly Parton, spills into a second day in the papers today. Journalists who were lucky enough to interview her recalling their memories of the woman in the Daily Express. Paul Sexton describes her as side-splittingly funny, bigger than country music itself. And the Daily Mirror's Tom Bryant recalls how she made him feel at the centre of her world, despite her enormous fame.
Amen to that. Remembering Dolly Parton. It's 6:11. Let's go back to that case then, extraordinary case. Meta, which owns Facebook and Instagram, agreeing to restrict American teenagers' use of its platforms with features including default time limits. The company has said it will pay out up to $18 billion to US states as part of this settlement over claims its platforms harmed children. It is the company's largest payment over child safety litigation to date. Zoe Kleinman is the BBC's technology editor. Zoe, before you take us through what changes there will be for American young people, we should specify. I mean, this is major, even though Facebook deny the claims.
Facebook, Meta, has not admitted any wrongdoing, but it is significant. And to be honest with you, it was a surprise. We were expecting weeks of courtroom drama. This was a massive case. It was 29 states of America, nearly two-thirds of the North American population, against this one tech giant. And we were going to hear from Mark Zuckerberg. There was, you know, there was a lot of sort of drama to come, if you like. And then suddenly, 5 days later, it's all over, and we hear that Meta has chosen to settle. But I have to say that the 5 days that they were in court hadn't gone hugely well, I don't think. There were some really rough times. One whistleblower, Arturo Bejar, who used to work at Instagram, he had said he'd told Mark Zuckerberg himself years ago that kids were coming to harm on the platform and that the bosses had done nothing. Another exec said he couldn't remember a slide deck in which he'd apparently written that Meta sometimes chose to pay fines rather than make changes when they violated regulations. So there was already a lot of damning evidence emerging from the state. And I think it's possible that Meta could see that this was not going to go well, because previous cases that it had also fought and had gone through with, it has already lost this year, you know, on similar grounds, on the issue of child safety.
What are the changes?
There are lots, and they range from things like hiding like counts for teens and removing filters on photos that make you look like you've had some kind of cosmetic surgery, to time limits. So a two-hour time limit by default, although that doesn't include time spent on messages. Overnight curfew by default, muting notifications during school hours. Now, these things are probably not going to be that difficult to introduce on a technical level, at least, and they're expected to come in within 6 months to a year by default, mainly for US teen users. But I'd be surprised if they stay in the US, because it's the kind of thing we've seen other countries, including here in the UK, calling for as well. Now, Meta says these measures are only going to work if everybody does them, right? Because otherwise everyone will just leave Instagram and go somewhere else. But this is quite a cutthroat industry, and they're all fierce rivals. That said, there's such a global backlash, isn't there, going on against social media, particularly its impact on children, that we might see the others like TikTok and YouTube and Snapchat being forced to follow suit.
Zoe Kleinman, we'll come back to this story. Our BBC technology editor, thank you.
It's 14 minutes past six. Police on Teesside are investigating a house fire which killed a woman and her seven-year-old niece yesterday morning. Now, this happened only around 2 miles away from the fatal crash on the A66, which killed two police officers and five other people at the weekend. Arrests have been made in both cases. Alison Freeman is our correspondent in Middlesbrough. Alison, just bring us up to date, first of all, with the latest on this tragic house fire.
Yeah, yesterday evening we heard from the mother of the woman who's died in this house fire. I'm just standing looking at the gutted house here in Grangetown. The woman who died is known as Natalie McDonald, and her mother told us that she was a beautiful soul who would have done anything for anybody. The other person that died in this fire was Natalie's seven-year-old niece, Valentina Foster. She'd just been staying with the family here for the holidays. Natalie's mother also told the BBC that Natalie's 15-year-old daughter managed to escape with a friend by kicking out a window, and that is what saved their lives. This fire broke out here just before 5:30 yesterday morning, and a 48-year-old woman is still in hospital in a critical condition. As you say, two people have been arrested on suspicion of murder. Now, the police have so far said that they are trying to establish what caused the fire here, but they're not ruling out links with organised crime. There is an increased police presence in the area, and they say that is because they want to reassure the local community.
And two devastating incidents, Alison, in just 1 week, has had a real impact on the community. It's brought people together in remembering, but it's also created tensions as well.
Yeah, that's right, Anna. We're just 2 miles or so away from the scene of that crash that happened on the A69, which killed seven people, two of them police officers. We know that Cleveland Police later today are going to be holding a minute's silence for those police officers. And here at the scene where we are today, there are flowers laid. So many things have happened here in just the past 7 days or so. Now, Cleveland Police hasn't linked the two incidents, but as I say, it's saying organised crime could be a factor in both of them. Going back to the crash on the A69, police have so far arrested 17 people. Two of them have been charged with offences, one with a firearms offence, one with drugs offences. There is a lot that has been going on here. We know that later this morning as well, the inquests are going to be opened into the deaths of the police officers, as well as the five young men that lost their lives in that crash.
Alison Freeman, our correspondent in Grangetown this morning. Thank you.
17 minutes past six. Sales more than doubled at the biggest publicly traded company in the world. That's the chip maker Nvidia. Theo Leggett has more and the rest of the business news. Morning, Theo.
Morning, Emma. Morning, Anna. Nvidia is at the very heart of the artificial intelligence boom. Its computer chips are used in major data centres around the world and power many advanced AI models. Its customers include the likes of Microsoft and Meta. And its latest results show revenues in the 3 months to July of $96.2 billion. That's £70 billion, with data centres providing $89 billion of those revenues, up 117%. The results came after the US markets had closed, but in after-hours trading, its shares rose nearly 5%. Well, Eileen Burbridge is founding partner of NFG Ventures and Passion Capital, which are both technology-focused venture capital funds. She joins me now. Morning, Eileen.
Morning, Theo.
These are huge numbers by any measure. Revenues more than doubled and possibly a little bit better than the markets were expecting.
Oh, it was quite a bit better, actually. I mean, on a percentage basis, because of the numbers we're talking, maybe just a few percentage points, but another $4 billion, basically, more than what the markets were expecting. Even so, the market's pretty brutal. And during the trading day, the share price just trickled down a little bit. And it wasn't until after hours trading that we really saw a nice boost.
Because the results were so good. Now, the reason this matters is NVIDIA is a sort of bellwether for the entire AI economy, isn't it? What impact do these results have on the tech sector and the rest of the market? Because everything's kind of linked and circular in the AI world, isn't it?
Yeah, I think there's a lot in there. To your first point, I do think this is going to continue to fuel the exuberance and the enthusiasm for what's happening in AI, as well as the potential and the interest to see what's going to come out of sort of service level applications. On the other hand, yes, there are still questions about how circular deals are fueling a lot of the growth and the investment. But NVIDIA made a great point, well, I would say a strong point yesterday, in saying, for example, that they had a huge order from Amazon and Amazon Web Services, where they were going to start deploying 2 million of NVIDIA's GPUs as a, I think, a counter argument to the circular deal point, because that's just straight revenue. That's just straight vendor relationship.
And everything in the garden seems lovely at the moment, but are there concerns that long-term AI simply can't live up to the hype, that some of the huge investments that are planned won't actually come to fruition and that there could be something of a bubble forming here?
Again, I think there is a lot of exuberance, and so there is a question about how long things will stay at this level. NVIDIA itself is forecasting 70% growth for next year as well. Again, that would be unprecedented and absolutely astronomical. There is, of course, a question about whether this trickles down into value for consumers, value for society, where we start to see this pan out. But for now, it's clear that AI infrastructure and compute and chips, such as those from NVIDIA, are here to stay and everybody's investing in them.
But from an investment point of view, NVIDIA has almost created a rod for its own back, hasn't it? Because expectations are now so high that in order to keep the share price moving upwards, great things have to happen.
That is true. Having said that, the market cap is now in excess of $5 trillion. So I don't know that its share price has to stay where it is. But you're right. In order for it to keep growing, the market does have to keep going as well. And it itself flagged supply chain challenges and memory shortages to come, which are going to affect future demand.
Well, you mentioned supply chain issues. I mean, the more demand there is, can chips be funneled through into the system quickly enough?
At the moment, they say that they're not meeting even all the demand that they're getting, and I think that's just going to get worse. They, for example, said that they're going to have to commit about $279 billion of their cash in order to fund memory purchases for themselves. So that is going to get tighter, and I do think that is going to be a concern, along with some of the other points you flagged as well.
Eileen, thank you very much indeed. That was Eileen Burbridge, who's founding partner of NFG Ventures and Passion Capital. Now, staying with the tech sector, we've been hearing earlier in the programme how Meta, the company behind Facebook and Instagram, has said it will pay up to $18 billion to settle claims brought by 29 US states that its platforms have harmed children. Well, investors gave the deal a cautious welcome. Meta's shares ended the day up just over 1%. For more on this, I'm joined now by Sunil Krishnan, head of multi-asset at Aviva Investors. And Sunil, $18 billion. More than £13 billion. I mean, that sounds like a lot, but Meta will have been bracing itself for an awful lot worse from this trial, won't it?
I think that's right. Good morning, everybody. I suppose if you look at the way that Meta had represented themselves in court, talking about potentially over $1 trillion of liability if the case went through and went against them, I mean, perhaps there's a little bit of hyperbole there, but I think in reality, investors will probably, you can tell from the share price reaction that investors will have expected potentially bigger numbers to be on the table, but also for this to just be a continued distraction over a long period of time. And I think in both those senses, they'll probably breathe a sigh of relief. I think you can tell from the fact that the price reaction was modest, that they weren't necessarily expecting trillions of dollars to be on the line. But all the same, I think they will probably breathe a sigh of relief and not necessarily expect an end to litigation, but potentially a reduction in its scope for future cases.
Well, that's a key point, isn't it? This ends one very big, very high profile case, but there are others to come.
No, there are plenty to come. And some of those are from private individuals. But for example, there was a state in the US that did not join this settlement. So the state of Florida effectively said, we don't think this is a large enough figure. We'll see you in court. So I certainly don't think it's an all clear. But I think for investors, what they often look for is for problems to stop getting bigger and take that as a sign of encouragement. I think they probably see this as the point that the problem stopped getting bigger.
And it's not just for investors in Meta, is it? I mean, this affects YouTube and TikTok. They were specifically cited in the settlement. They've been called on to implement the same safety features, and part of the settlement money depends on that. Do you think this is going to happen?
It feels as though there will now be very strong momentum, whether that be through the courts, through public opinion, or through the discussions with investors and analysts, for that to happen. So I certainly don't think it would be a surprise to see other companies follow suit. And indeed, those companies themselves, for a long time, as part of their lobbying efforts, have said, we would really benefit in some ways from law or legal precedent to stop a race for the bottom where we're having to compete harder and harder for engagement, but instead some kind of a floor of minimum standards is set.
Sunil Krishnan, Head of Multi-Asset at Aviva Investors, thank you very much indeed. Now, the AI investment boom that's been powering sales at Nvidia and other tech companies has also been driving demand for the raw materials needed to build data centers and so on, and that includes copper. But here's the problem. Supplies are already coming under pressure because it's also needed in many other sectors, while output simply isn't keeping pace with that growing demand. It's an issue for the UK because copper is vital for our infrastructure. And for more on this, I'm joined now by Dr. Maurizio Bragnani. He's the CEO of Tratos Group, which manufactures copper and fibre optic cables for the likes of Network Rail, National Grid and Scottish Power. Good morning to you.
Good morning to you. Good morning.
First of all, set out for us, will you, why copper cabling and such like is so important?
Well, let's think about this conversation or think about anything that is a modern time. If you think about cloud, it's not in the cloud. Cloud is a server connected with another server with cables. And that service, these data center or servers or computer, calling as you want it, they need power and they need telecommunication. So they need fiber optic and copper to give power and to make sure that our modern life is still a modern life that we are living.
Okay, it's badly needed. Now, the price of copper is trading at near record highs because of those supply pressures I mentioned. How's this impacting your business?
Well, impacting the price for any common citizen. So basically, everything has been doubled. Copper, just to give you an idea, copper just in this month, in the August time, has been increased about 5.9%, has been increased 15 times from the beginning of the years. It means that that same cables that was costing £1 now cost £1.14. And that is means that has been transferred the price to the clients and means that we as a taxpayer at the end we pay more. That is an evidence of that. But the reason of the increase of the copper, in particular in August, that normally is not like that, is because there is a lot of factors. Of course, there is a huge demand from AI, data center, electrical vehicle, renewable, but also because everyone, they are afraid what is going to happen to tariff. So there was a massive transfer of a physical stock of copper from London Metal Exchange to United States because they were trying to avoid the potential tariff in the future.
There's been a bit of stockpiling going on.
Yes, correct. And so basically they are trying to see the future. But what is the trends? What is the trends in the last 10 years? Copper moved from £4,000 at tons to £10,000. That's been doubling in the last, from after pandemic. And this is the trend. The trend is that the copper is going to increase. And what we have seen as an immediate effect, that a lot of orders, a lot of contracts, in particular with the utility, has been postponed because they are looking to find alternatives or they are looking to moderate or mitigate the increase of the cost.
So business is effectively slowing down because the costs of the raw materials are too high. Can anything be done about it?
Well, there is alternatives, that is aluminium, it's an alternative on copper, but the point is that the demand is really huge. And in this moment, utilities, railways have to make a decision if they want to invest in strategically in, for example, cables or other components, or they want to leave it to the market. I give you an example. The cable industry, they are in this moment leaving, abandoning the telecommunication market because data center, they are more interested because they are paying more money. Because if you don't have a data center, the country is not going to have the AI. So you cannot have AI unless you have a data center. Data center pay more than telecommunication for fiber optic. Fiber optic has moved from £9 per kilometers to £14. £14, so 0.9 against 40, so it's been huge. So basically,
the prices are going up and contracts are going to be slowed down. I'm really sorry, Dr. Maurizio Bragnani, we're going to have to leave it there. I'll be back with more in an hour's time.
Thank you, Theo. 29 minutes past six now, time for the sport. Mike Williams is out on a little field trip this morning.
Yes, good morning, Anna. We are back at Lord's, where it is all quiet here at the moment this morning. The light starting to break through over the last half an hour or so on what is the first day of the second test between England and Pakistan. The large white covers are stretched out over the outfield in front of me at the moment. It has, I'm afraid to report, already been raining here this morning, with more rain forecast later today. And fair to say, a little bit of a dark cloud still remains over English cricket after the latest late-night drinking controversy involving one of their players. You'll remember bowler Brydon Carse was removed from this England squad for the second test after he was briefly arrested whilst on a night out in Derby on Saturday. Well, bowler Josh Tung says England captain Joe Root has hammered home his message to the squad about their off-field behaviour.
It was a chat that was needed. It was a very good chat from Rooty. Very clear on the messaging, what it's like to be an England cricketer, that we're very privileged to put on that England shirt, and we want to show kids growing up how good it is to play for England in front of thousands of people.
Well, let's hear from the captain, shall we? Joe Root led his side to a comprehensive innings victory over Pakistan in the first test at Headingley last week, but he is expecting the tourists to respond here at Lord's.
We know the individual brilliance that lies within that team and what Pakistan are capable of collectively. We also know that whenever we play anyone at Lord's, they generally raise their game. It's a very special opportunity for any touring team.
Well, what about England's opponents today? Pakistan captain Babar Azam missed the first test at Headingley last week through injury, but he's back for this match.
I think we're not playing up to the mark, but credit to England team, the way he's playing. After that, we are sit together and discuss our mistakes, and then we are just forget that things and looking forward to the tomorrow match, and just believe on yourself and just play a good cricket.
Plenty more preview to the second test throughout the morning. We will be here all throughout the programme, and we'll be joined by the former England captain, David Gower, a little later on in the programme. And of course, full coverage of the first day of the second test on Test Match Special later on BBC Sounds. Just briefly elsewhere in football, victories for Tottenham, Everton, Newcastle and Bradford in the second round of the League Cup last night. Elsewhere, Hearts are through to the league phase of the Conference League after beating Rapid Vienna on penalties. In tennis, Britain's Jacob Fernley, Toby Samuel, Harry Wendelken and Harriet Dart are now one win away from a place in the US Open main draw after coming through the second round of qualifying in New York overnight. And Britain's Matthew Brennan claimed his second win at cycling's Vuelta a España yesterday in a sprint finish on stage five.
Thank you, Mike.
Music that moves you all summer long with the BBC Proms. From Bond and Beyond to the Miles Davis Centenary. And Elgar's Cello Concerto. The BBC Proms. Watch on iPlayer, listen on BBC Sounds.
The time now is 27 minutes to seven. You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Anna Foster in Salford, Emma Barnett here in London, and now a summary of the news with Chris Aldridge.
Rescue teams have worked through the night to locate survivors after a massive flood and mudslide in the border region between Nepal and Tibet. In Nepal, more than 160 people have been killed and more than 800 tourists are missing, including many from the UK. There are also fears for hundreds of people believed to be on the Tibetan side of the border, where the Chinese authorities say rescue operations are being hampered by uncertain weather conditions. A whistleblower has warned that plans to heavily restrict American children's usage of Facebook and Instagram as part of an $18 billion US court settlement by the tech giant Meta won't make young people safer online. The firm has denied any wrongdoing after agreeing its largest payment to date over claims it harmed children. Two people who died in a house fire in Grangetown near Middlesbrough yesterday have been named as Natalie McDonald and her 7-year-old niece Valentina Foster. Two men have been arrested on suspicion of murder. The fire happened a few miles from Saturday's fatal car crash, which killed 7 people, including 2 police officers. Police say they're keeping an open mind but are not ruling out possible links to organised crime. Police in France say one person was killed when a man drove a car into a crowd in the northwestern city of Caen last night. 10 other people were injured, 7 of them seriously. Reports suggest the incident happened after a fight in a local bar. A 26-year-old suspect has been arrested. A second worker at Frankfurt Airport has died after apparently catching malaria. 4 other members of staff are being treated in hospital after contracting the disease. Health professionals in Germany believe it must have been transmitted by mosquitoes carried on an inbound plane. A memoir by Jason Arday, the Cambridge professor who died after stepping down during a plagiarism row, is going on sale in the UK today. Entitled Great and Unfortunate Things, it was made available in the US earlier this month, just days before his death.
And we'll talk more about that before 7. Thank you, Chris.
在昨天下午，边防连已去现场进行了勘查，目前。
A huge rescue effort is underway on the Chinese border with Nepal, where hundreds of people were washed away by an explosive flash flood yesterday. What you're hearing there is the sound of China's state broadcaster CCTV, which has released drone footage of a flooded valley this morning. It is reporting that the key road leading to that border area in Tibet has been destroyed, which of course is hampering the rescue operation. And the number of people missing is rising. It's now into the hundreds. It includes many foreign tourists, including more than 30 from the UK. But the remoteness of that area makes calculating how many people might have been affected overall very difficult. Well, we'll hear from Nepal later in the programme. Our correspondent Laura Bicker is in Beijing watching the situation in Tibet, which is controlled by China. Laura, what are the authorities saying at the moment about the situation?
Well, in the last few hours, they've told us that 558 people are missing and that half of those missing, 260, are foreigners. They have managed to rescue 2 people and 3 people have been confirmed dead as we speak now. I think one of the things that's unfolding in the last hour is that the difficulty reaching this area is not just in part to the road, but also they're trying to stabilise an upstream lake. They are worried that it too could burst its banks and then wash away the rescue teams. Within the last couple of hours, around 141 rescuers have managed to reach that port town of Geerong. Now, that is the town, if anyone has seen the footage, where you see this wall of water come crashing through the building, shoving aside trucks and heavy machinery and people, hundreds of them, running for their lives. Getting to that area is extremely difficult. Even the People's Liberation Army and the Air Force are struggling. They have managed to fly a reconnaissance drone over the region in the hope of both finding survivors and trying to assess the stability to get more rescue teams in.
There are challenges on both sides of that border. And where you are, Laura, and the way that you look at things, obviously the management of an incident like this, very much controlled by the Chinese authorities, as is the information which is released about it.
Yeah, it's a very good point to make to your listeners, Anna. I mean, I'm sitting in Beijing for a very good reason. This region is one of the most controlled areas in the whole of China. You need a special Tibet to go there. Foreigners, are, especially foreign media, are certainly not allowed without explicit permission. And we do know that state media have managed to get through, and that is how we are getting our information. When it comes to the severity of the situation, we get an idea from how state media react. And all of this came from the top down. President Xi Jinping gave his instructions personally for all-out efforts to be made to rescue any survivors. So that gives you an idea of how seriously Chinese teams are treating this. What it is worth saying also is that they are highly experienced at this type of rescue. This area is prone to earthquakes, and they have machinery, they have reconnaissance drones, they have X-ray machines all nearby to try to check for survivors. But so far, even 24 hours on, they've only managed to rescue two people alive.
Thank you, Laura. Laura Bicker there, our correspondent in Beijing, watching the situation in Tibet. We'll hear from Nepal a little later in the programme.
We will indeed. It's 21 minutes to seven. The government says the first young people have now started work through its new jobs guarantee scheme. It's aimed at 18 to 24-year-olds who've been claiming universal credit and looking for a job for 18 months. We're actually going to hear from one of them on the scheme just before 8 o'clock on the programme. Ian Watson's here, our political correspondent. Can you tell us more?
I can indeed, Emma. Yeah, this scheme is going to be offering up to 25 hours of paid employment alongside skills training for young people, and initial placements with a well-known pharmacy chain have begun in areas of high youth unemployment, including South Wales, Central Scotland and, yes, Greater Manchester. The government's saying 90,000 young people will be helped into work in this scheme by 2029. But just to put this in context, the latest figures on NEETs, those not in education, training or employment, we're going to get those numbers later today, and we're expecting those numbers to hover at around a million, or one in eight young people. That's up by a quarter of a million since 2021, so still a big post-pandemic problem. Now, we're not expecting any further policy solutions from the government today. They're concentrating on their jobs guarantee scheme, but we will get more when Alan Milburn, the former cabinet minister, issues his report on NEETs in the autumn. But his initial report in spring shows, I think, the scale of the challenge facing Andy Burnham. He was saying there's still far more being spent on benefits than on these type of schemes which help people into work. In fact, he had a very stark statistic. He said that for every £1 spent on employment support, £25 is spent on cash benefits.
Ian, we will get into this with more detail certainly as well with those people going through this, but also speaking to Pat McFadden. It's 20 to 7. Let's turn our attention now to, we were just hearing that the memoir of Jason Arday, the former University of Cambridge professor at the centre of a plagiarism row who was found dead earlier this month, will be published in the UK today. An inquest into his death opened just yesterday. It's called Great and Unfortunate Things. It's published by Simon & Schuster, and it's being published today in accordance with what Mr. Arday's family wanted to happen. Katie Razzle's here, our culture and media editor. Katie, what can we say of this, I suppose? It's definitely a publication moment with a difference, many differences.
Well, it absolutely is, Emma. As you say, it's been published in the UK. It's actually already been published a few weeks ago in the US. And the family have issued a statement saying, as you said, it's only right that they honour Jason's wishes to publish his memoir. The publisher is Simon & Schuster, and they've described the book as an unforgettable book about resilience and love. The academic, who had autism and was, as you say, until recently, Cambridge University's professor of sociology of education, had said he was nonverbal until 11 and illiterate until 18, which makes it a really fascinating story before everything that happened, of course. And listeners will likely remember that for the few weeks up to his untimely death on August the 14th, Jason Arday's name was making headlines. What started as claims about Cambridge University's youngest ever black professor plagiarising his PhD thesis back in 2015, quickly expanded to investigations into other claims he'd made about his life, some of which appeared not to stand up to scrutiny. Cambridge originally stood by him, pointing out that Liverpool John Moores University, where he'd done his PhD, had already investigated last year and cleared him of any wrongdoing. Then Cambridge launched an investigation into his appointment after receiving what it said was new information. And he resigned a few hours after that announcement, talking about the unrelenting level of public scrutiny. Even before his death, there were questions about why there was so much reporting about him. And for some, it was a story about the failures of Cambridge's diversity policies. The argument was that the university promoted a man in the wake of the Black Lives Matter movement, who they say their investigation showed wasn't qualified. It's worth remembering, of course, less than 1% of professors are black, and less than half of that number at Cambridge, or that percentage. For others, though, what happened was a lynching by the media. That term was used by Lord Simon Woolley at the vigil held for Jason Arday after his death. The Cambridge Chancellor called what happened a racist feeding frenzy. Now, his family have said in advance of the publication that there's been so much that's been written and said about our beloved brother, son, father, partner and uncle, mostly, they say, by people who don't know the truth of what he experienced and we experienced as a family, or what an extraordinary person he was. We're happy to allow the book to speak for itself and won't comment further on its content.
That book out today in the UK. Katie Razzle, our culture and media editor. Thank you.
16 minutes to 7. Let's head to Germany, where a party that wants to cut public funding for art that it sees as anti-German and teach children less about Hitler could soon take power in one eastern state. Regional governments hold significant influence in Germany, including things like running their own culture and education systems. And the far-right Alternative for Deutschland party is way ahead in the polls in Saxony-Anhalt. Our Berlin correspondent Jessica Parker reports.
A crowd cheers at an Alternative für Deutschland rally in the town of Querfurt. It's here in the region of Saxony-Anhalt that the far-right party's aiming to take power at a state level for the very first time.
Among the hundreds and hundreds of people who are here at this event is a man who is enthusiastically waving around a large German flag, the black, red and gold. Now, Germany, traditionally not really seen as a flag-waving country, but one of the things the AfD is pushing at this election is the idea of national pride.
The party here essentially claims that Germany's too consumed by its Nazi past, and that's eroded the country's confidence.
Der Zweite Weltkrieg geht uns nichts mehr an.
The Second World War has nothing to do with us anymore. That's gone.
Gerd is a 70-year-old AfD supporter. Attached to his mobility scooter is a small, frayed German flag.
We have to look out for ourselves, for our times. Finally becoming the German people we once were, the land of poets and thinkers.
Das Land der Dichter und Denker.
Und was sagst du?
Nein!
Doch, sieht voll aus, oder?
Ist das etwa unsere Jukebox?
But today's German culture is also in the AfD's sights. Actors rehearse at a local theatre. The plot, a modern German twist on Romeo and Juliet.
Was?
Du spürst das doch auch!
Nein.
This playhouse, like most in Germany, is heavily state-funded. But the AfD has pledged, in its election plans, to defund what it calls anti-German art.
How can somebody say it's not German enough, and what is what does it mean?
Frank Martin Widmeier is the director at Eisleben Theatre.
This is playing with Nazi propaganda again.
Really?
Yes,
you
I
think
would say
that?
Yes, definitely. They are reproducing this kind of propaganda to threaten people.
But the AfD are saying that German memory culture, they think it's sort of turned into a guilt complex.
You don't have to feel guilty, especially not born after the Second World War, but you have to deal with all of that to make it never happen again. That's part of our DNA in Germany.
I'm stood in a huge cemetery in the capital of Saxony-Anhalt, Magdeburg. It's raining, and I'm looking at rows and rows of German war graves. It's more than 80 years since the end of World War II. What you have now, today, in this election, is a political battle over German memory culture, a core part of this country's identity. Memory culture is the commitment to face up to the Holocaust, to Nazi crimes. But in this region, the AfD wants schools to focus less on that era. Back at the rally in Querfurt, I grab a word with the AfD's lead man in the state, Ulrich Siegmund.
What do you say to people who would say your push for a more patriotic vision of Germany, in some cases amounts to downplaying the Nazi past of this country.
It's the most normal thing in the world, in almost every country of the world, that people are proud of their own country, proud of their culture, their heritage. In this country, though, that's unfortunately not the case anymore, and we want to get that back. We have a diverse history, stretching back many hundreds of years, and we want to teach that history in its entirety, with all its highs and lows, but with pride and a positive outlook.
A party long accused of dangerous revisionism claims to champion a new patriotism. And despite this being one of the states where the AfD's classed as right-wing extremist by domestic intelligence, it could soon make history here as it seeks to challenge Germany's perception of history itself.
That's our Berlin correspondent Jessica Parker reporting. It's 11 minutes to 7.
Britain is to host an international counter-terrorism hub to identify and catch ultra-violent extremists, I should say, across the world as part of efforts to stop the repeat of attacks like the one that happened in Southport. Experts from the US, Australia, Canada and New Zealand will be deployed to work alongside British counterparts. But why now and what will it achieve? Jonathan Hall, KC, independent reviewer of terror legislation, is here to help us understand this. Jonathan, what's your view with what we know of this hub so far? Why now and what can it do that isn't already being done?
Yeah, well, it's obviously a reaction to Southport. There's some comfort, I think, in sharing lessons. I mean, all of the Anglophone countries are suffering with people are obsessed about, say, school shooting or want to carry out some sort of non-ideological massacre. So, you know, getting together, there's some comfort in that. I wouldn't be too excited about it, though. And we've known about this phenomenon for many, many years. And, I mean, it really doesn't get to the root problem, which is the prevalence of really disgusting stuff online, which is really available. Yes, it's quite nice that you're going to get some officers from across the world sitting together and exchanging information, maybe identifying a few people. But I mean, I can tell you, having spent time with young prisoners who've really gone down the rabbit hole, become obsessed about attack planning, that it's what they can see online. For example, torture videos. I mean, it's horrible to say, but they're very readily available. Mm. School shooting manifestos, live streaming. And that's not to mention the availability of really quite dangerous AI models. And I'm afraid the government is showing a real lack of ambition at the moment in trying to set out for the British public what they are prepared to do to deal with it. So, yeah, it's quite good.
It's quite good. I mean, it sounds like you think it's going to be a sort of talking shop as opposed to perhaps the most effective that it could be. What would be showing ambition, though? Because I'm mindful of the fact when we're speaking today, you know, we're hearing in more detail soon about that large amount of money Meta's going to be paying out and changes certainly for American young people that are going to be made online to make it a safer place. And yet you're discussing torture videos.
Yeah, well, as I say, the true crime community and looking at torture videos is a real phenomenon. It seems to be a sort of gateway in for people who, and you remember Axel Rudakabana, the killer at Southport, was completely obsessed about massacres and torture and things like that. He watched live stream videos. Now, what's going to happen? This Five Eyes community is going to have no impact on that at all. Fine, it's very good what happened in America, but you'll notice that are changes driven by US litigation. But actually, we're here in Britain, and the government hasn't really outlined what it's going to do, if at all, to try and deal with some of these things. I mean, give you an example. I can go online in 5 minutes and I can find the manifesto of any number of terrorists who are encouraging young people to carry out more attacks. There are some trade-offs, obviously, if you are going to remove, say, torture videos. Again, you slightly mocked it, but it's so important, this school shooting.
I'm not mocking that. I meant more like... I meant we're talking about the safety of young people. And I don't know why that came across like that. Wasn't at all intended.
No,
It was to say that when we're talking about that, how does this work with the Online Safety Act? How does this work with trying to make the internet safer and therefore us safer?
Right. Well, I mean, the Online Safety Act is simply incapable of dealing with these really high harm situations. And I mean, just to show you what I mean, we've almost become accepting that there should be readily available pictures of people torturing each other online. The Online Safety Act says that tech companies have to have what they call proportionate systems. But that is almost to accept that if you really go looking for it, you will find it. And as I say, when I've spent time with young attack planners, they've easily been able to find it. So I think the government needs to go a lot further to say to the public, either we're not going to do anything about it. In other words, we're going to tolerate this material and kids will find it and they will become radicalised. Or, and there will be trade-offs involved, we are going to do things about it. For example, one of the key ways of blocking people from accessing this material is that they don't use what they call VPNs. Now, VPNs are readily available. And for high harm situations, people's ability to access VPNs, in other words, to pretend that they're accessing the internet from outside the UK, can drive a coach and horses through the current controls that the UK is proposing. The government, I think, has got to really level with the public and say, this is what we are willing to do. And it may involve some compromises, if you like, with free speech, if that's your concern. On the other hand, it may be that we're simply not going to do anything at all. So, you know, what's happening is fine. My wish would be for the government to develop lots and lots of policies and to come forward to the government and to parents and to children and say, this is what we propose that we can do. What do you want to do? At the moment, I hear no leadership at all from ministers. And as we know, all of the changes, the under 16 ban, the ability to look at AI content within the Online Safety Act, that was all driven by politicians in the House of Lords. In other words, the government is not coming forward with policies that I think can make a real difference.
We're going to have to leave it there. Jonathan Hall, KC, Independent Review of Terror Legislation. Thank you.
6 minutes to 7. There are calls for an urgent community safety briefing on Teesside after a woman and her niece died in a house fire in Grangetown. It is just 2 miles from the scene of the weekend's fatal crash on the A66, which killed 2 police officers and 5 more people who were travelling in the car that hit them as it travelled the wrong way along the road after a pursuit. 2 people have been arrested on suspicion of murder after this latest incident. Councillor Alec Brown joins us, the Labour leader of Redcar and Cleveland Council. Good morning.
Good morning, Dana. Thank you for having me on.
Thanks for speaking to us. We should say that police do not know or have not confirmed at this stage whether there are links between this new incident and organised crime, but they're certainly looking into it. What about the safety of people living in that area? They've been through and seen a lot in the last 7 days, and in some cases they don't feel safe. What would you say to them?
I would say Grangetown, South Bank, the estates, they absolutely need to feel safe in their own homes. Myself as council leader, I've been liaison with Cleveland Police, who've been absolutely brilliant throughout. I mean, under the circumstances yesterday, they were unbelievable, making 2 arrests on the tragic fire that happened yesterday morning within hours of it happening. Grangetown's set at the moment, and we're doing our very utmost from a council point of view. For instance, I've called for an urgent meeting on Friday of all members from across the chambers with police and social housing providers, because I know the residents out there are asking councillors, their councillors, rightly so, for reinsurances, that they are safe in their own home.
One of the things that's been really problematic over the last week or so, and it's sensitive, but I think it's important to address it, is that there's been real tension in the community about the fact that there are people who don't want to see a moral equivalence drawn between the deaths of 2 police officers and the deaths of the 5 people who were travelling in the Passat. And that's been very divisive. It's caused a lot of upset. How does somebody in a position like yours deal with that?
It's a very difficult situation, and of course the first and most paramount thing on everyone's minds is the safety of everybody in them communities you've just asked me about, and people feeling safe in their own communities. And I think with any messaging, that's always the first thing that we need to do. We certainly don't want to be the triggers for any civil unrest and causing the police more distress at one of their most tragic times they've ever had. So it's a bit of a tightrope, as you can imagine. However, I'm happy to go on record and say, you know, the families of the 5 people in that car, they didn't choose for them to be in that car, and my heart does go out to them. However, I think the public are rightly so, you know, supporting the two police officers and the families. I mean, nobody deserves to lose a life when they go to work.
Just as a final and brief thought, people who live in places like Grangetown, South Bank, that you know, that I know, it's very easy for those people to feel left behind, isn't it, when they look at the world around them. They are places that often do not have the attention and the help and support that they need.
Yeah, I'm from an estate of the same ilk, from Redcar. When sometimes that you live around people that may be suffering poverty or other social issues, it can be that uniform sort of consciousness that we're left behind. But I can assure the people at Grangetown and South Bank, they're as important to me as the people from any other estate in the borough, and we're working tirelessly to ensure that they do feel safe in their own houses.
Thank you so much. I appreciate that. Time's against us, but thank you, Councillor Alec Brown, the Labour leader of Redcar and Cleveland Council.
A quick weather from Ben Rich.
Thank you very much. England and Wales will see some very heavy thundery downpours today. Currently across the south of England, Wales, the Midlands, East Anglia, we've got some really heavy rain. Could well cause some localised flooding, some travel disruption. That will shift into northern England as we head on through the morning and into the afternoon. Sunshine and heavy showers behind. Northern Ireland and Scotland will be drier, patchy cloud and sunny spells, and temperatures north to south of 17 to 25 degrees.
Masterfully done. You're listening to Today with Anna Foster and Salford Emma Barnett here in London.
Good morning, it's 7 o'clock on Tuesday, Thursday. Thursday the 27th of August. The headlines this morning: more than 1,000 people are missing, including dozens of tourists from the UK, after a huge flash flood and mudslide on the border between Nepal and Tibet. A former Facebook engineer has warned that restrictions on social media use for children in the US, agreed as part of a huge court settlement by the tech giant Meta, won't improve online safety. And a British man has become the world's first patient to have a tumour removed through brain surgery with live artificial intelligence assistance.
Amazing. Coming up this hour, could a solution for living longer without diseases be found in a colony of tiny mouse-eared bats?
Bats in general hold some really interesting clues for how we could live healthier and longer lives.
And?
Oh my God, there's a shared message board. We found other agents.
Many agents have simultaneously discovered messaging. They are a collective.
The AI bots that went rogue, posting to each other on a message board as they hacked into a company. I mean, it's incredible and also not going so well at times, it seems. We'll get into that and more, but first, the BBC News is read by Chris Aldridge.
Rescuers are racing to find the survivors of a massive flash flood and mudslide on the border between Nepal and Tibet. At least 160 people have died in Nepal and more than 800 people are missing, including at least 579 tourists. On the Tibetan side of the border, Chinese media reports indicate that three people have died and more than 500 are unaccounted for. Here's Aruna Iyengar.
Officials describe the destruction as beyond imagination. Entire settlements have been hit, roads and infrastructure ripped apart. CCTV footage at Girong Port, near the border between Nepal and China, shows residents running for their lives as a wall of mud and debris overwhelmed buildings and tossed cars and lorries aside. Why this devastating flood happened has not been confirmed, but the US Geological Survey said a collapsing glacier had caused what it called catastrophic impacts downstream. This is the worst natural disaster to hit Nepal since an earthquake in 2015, which killed 9,000 people. International tourists are among those missing, including dozens of British nationals. A tour company in Nepal, Alpine Ecotrek, says it has not been able to make contact with a group including 12 Britons who were booked on a walking tour to Mount Kailash in Tibet.
A whistleblower has warned that plans to heavily restrict children's usage of Facebook and Instagram as part of a multi-billion dollar US court settlement by the tech giant Meta won't make young people safer online. Meta has denied any wrongdoing after agreeing its largest payment to date over claims it harmed children. Here's our North America technology correspondent, Lily Jamali.
As part of this settlement, Meta is agreeing to make sweeping changes to its apps for users in the U.S. These include placing a two-hour daily limit by default for teenagers across the Meta platforms, Instagram and Facebook, as well as nighttime restrictions. Meta will also pay states penalties of up to $18 billion, equivalent to more than 13 billion pounds, with the full amount kicking in only if competitors TikTok and Google's YouTube agree to similar changes. But Arturo Bejar, a former Meta safety engineer who was the first witness to testify against the company in the trial, told the BBC that the settlement would not make children safer online.
Behind my whistleblowing was this internal knowledge that the harm that the company was reporting publicly was 100 to 400 times less than what the new people were experiencing, especially young people. And the agreement as it stands does not make that better.
Meta still faces significant litigation from multiple U.S. school districts and thousands of individuals who say the company's apps led to harms from depression to suicide.
Two people who died in a house fire in Grangetown near Middlesbrough yesterday have been named as Natalie McDonald and her seven-year-old niece, Valentina Foster. Two men have been arrested on suspicion of murder. The fire happened close to the location of Saturday's fatal car crash, which killed seven people, including two police officers. Police say they're keeping an open mind but are not ruling out possible links to organised crime. Fiona Trott reports.
Bright and bubbly. That's how Natalie McDonald's family described the 34-year-old who got married just 9 months ago. Her seven-year-old niece, Valentina, was described as a cute little girl who hours before the blaze was dancing around the living room making videos. The house fire is about 2 miles from Saturday's fatal car crash. Five men died after colliding with a police car on the A66. Four of them had previous criminal convictions. PC Tom Clough and PC Matthew Blades were also killed. 17 people have been arrested as part of the crash investigation. Two have been charged. It's a fast-moving and complex inquiry.
Police in France say one person was killed when a car was driven into a crowd in the northwestern city of Caen last night. 10 other people were injured, 7 of them seriously. Officials say they do not believe the incident was motivated by terrorism. A 26-year-old man has been arrested. A second worker at Frankfurt Airport has died after apparently contracting malaria. Health professionals in Germany believe it must have been transmitted by mosquitoes carried on an inbound plane, as Michael Daventry explains.
Malaria is both preventable and curable, but it sometimes goes undiagnosed if a sufferer has not themselves travelled to an affected area. The precise circumstances of the Frankfurt deaths are uncertain. Germany's Robert Koch Institute believes the disease was spread by an imported Anopheles mosquito, but it isn't clear from which country. Frankfurt Airport does have direct flights to destinations where malaria is present, such as sub-Saharan Africa and India. Mosquito traps have now been installed at the airport and those caught will be sent for genetic tests to find out more about their origin. Cases like these are rare, although the latest outbreak of imported malaria at a German airport was also at Frankfurt 3 years ago.
New research published in The Lancet Psychiatry suggests mental health patients are 3 times less likely to be admitted to a psychiatric hospital if they're treated using an approach that closely involves their family and friends. The study, led by University College London, found patients were more satisfied with their care as a result. More from our social affairs editor, Alison Holt.
Researchers looked at the impact of an approach to mental health treatment called open dialogue. Patients see the same professionals over time as often as they need, and family and friends are closely involved in the sessions. The system originated in Finland in the 1980s, but this is the first randomised controlled trial. It found patients were 3 times less likely to need hospital treatment than those with more standard care, and if they did, the time they spent there was halved. However, the number of relapses patients had wasn't reduced.
A man has successfully had a tumour removed from his brain in what's been called the first surgery of its kind, guided by live artificial intelligence assistance. Surgeons at University College London Hospital developed the AI tool and performed the operation, which saved the patient's sight as part of a trial. More from our health reporter, Smita Mundasad.
The patient's tumour was benign, but dangerously close to important blood vessels and nerves, leaving him at risk of going blind. The team trained their AI tool on hundreds of videos of previous operations, many more than most surgeons will do in their lifetime. They then used the AI tool in real time to help highlight where the sometimes hidden vessels and nerves were most likely to be, and to mark up the safest place to remove the tumour. Researchers hope that with larger trials, using AI in this way will help surgery become both safer and faster.
A memoir by Jason Arday, the Cambridge professor who died after stepping down during a plagiarism row, is going on sale in the UK today. The publisher Simon & Schuster announced on Monday that the book would be released as planned. The Japanese avant-garde artist Yayoi Kusama, who's best known as the Polka Dot Queen, has died aged 97. She's best known for mirror installations, colourful images and decorated pumpkin sculptures, taking inspiration from hallucinations of flashing lights, dots and flowers she'd seen since childhood. Instantly recognisable in her bright red wig and bold spotted outfits, Yayoi Kusama achieved huge commercial success in her later years as she worked from a psychiatric hospital in Tokyo, where she lived voluntarily for the second half of her life.
Thank you, Chris. It's 9 minutes past seven. An urgent rescue mission is underway in Nepal and Tibet after a huge explosive flash flood hit the border area yesterday morning, destroying pretty much everything in its path. Hundreds of people are missing and that number keeps rising. At this stage, the authorities in Nepal say approaching 500 foreign tourists are out of contact. More than 30 of those are thought to be UK nationals. China's state broadcaster says over 500 people are missing in Tibet. Attempts to find any survivors are being really hampered by the remoteness of that particular region and also the fact that roads and bridges have in many cases simply been washed away. Well, I've been speaking to Professor Bishal Nath Upreti, who's the president of the Nepal Centre for Disaster Management, to get the very latest picture.
It's a huge damage. And in fact, up to the 2015 earthquake, this is one of the largest disasters that we have in Nepal. That was earthquake. And this is, you know, a kind of flood. We call it flood, but actually it's a kind of a debris flow, dam collapse and like that. So it was such a huge amount of water. You can imagine it is 20 million cubic meters excess water on the river. And it was like a tsunami from the sky, you know. It's such a huge debris. And everything on the way was completely washed out. Villages and villages along the almost 40 to 50 kilometers were completely wiped out, which were at the lower altitude. The surge was tens of meters high, or maybe 100 meters high, 100, 200 meters high at some places. Well, when it reached to the border, at that time, nobody knew about it. There was no early warning from China's side. Perhaps they also didn't know about it. And then, you know, fortunately, there was messes going on further downstream. So because of that, a lot of lives were saved, but the villages and villages were completely wiped out. It was absolutely disastrous. 157 bodies are recovered from different areas, almost for 100 kilometers downstream or 150 kilometers downstream. And according to the latest data, 579 tourists travelers are missing. We also had disaster in Tibet side, and where they think probably 260 foreigners were there. 558 people are missing in northern side in Tibet also. Most of them are unaccounted for. And missing people, if you think of within Nepali, this thing, 62 Nepalis among the tourists, 62 Nepalis, not tourists all, but they were also guides and other things. 62 Nepalis are missing with the tourist group, I mean, you know, and health workers. You know, you have we have one Langtang National Park there. So people were working there, as well as the Langtang project, hydro project. 60 people are missing. There were bus passengers going to further down, 34 people. Security people alone, 79 army people and police together. one of the villages just downstream of the border area, there is a village called Timure, where almost there were 100 or more houses were there. Only 4 or 5 are standing. It's completely destroyed and washed away. 14 of our hydropowers are damaged, powerhouses and, you know, structures are damaged. Not only that, you know, you have bridges along the rivers. So can you imagine 22 concrete bridges and 5 belly bridges were completely washed out? 45 foot bridges, so important for the rural people, are washed out. The loss of infrastructure, if we calculate, estimated calculation by the government is $1.3 billion. It's a huge amount for a country like Nepal, and it's about 3% of our GDP. That's what is the preliminary assessment that we have.
Yeah, it's, as you say, it has a huge ripple effect, not just on people, as you say, not just on people in that area. It spreads wider and wider, doesn't it? In terms of the rescue teams, what approach are they taking when so much of the infrastructure, as you described, the roads, the bridges, has been washed away?
So this is the most challenging thing right now. Today also there will be a lot of search and rescue will be going on. So only the helicopters can be used to reach there. Complete washed out from along the road. And it will take weeks and weeks to open these roads. And now the biggest problem I see from today onwards is how do we bring the relief materials there? So it's such a huge population and so scattered. So not a lot of people can go there for relief work distribution and all that. So they have to walk on the way. And even the walking along the road is so difficult now.
Professor, thank you for joining us this morning.
Thank you
so
much.
Really appreciate it. Professor Bishal Nath Upreti, who's the president of the Nepal Center for Disaster Management.
It's 14 minutes past seven. Today, the memoir of Jason Arday, the former University of Cambridge professor at the centre of a plagiarism row, who was found dead earlier this month, will be published. An inquest into his death opened yesterday. Great and Unfortunate Things will be published by Simon & Schuster today in accordance with what Mr. Arday's family has wanted to happen. The academic resigned as a Cambridge professor after allegations of plagiarism and questions about some of his achievements, which appeared across the media for days and days. He denied the claims. His appointment as Cambridge's youngest black professor, aged 37, in 2023 was hailed at the time as a progressive moment. Now comes the posthumous publishing of his book. But should it be released as planned? Alexandra Pringle is the former editor-in-chief of Bloomsbury Publishing. And in our conversation, I began by asking her whether it was ethical to publish the book at this point.
Yes, I don't see why not. I mean, the book was scheduled, it was all done and dusted. I don't think it's a question of ethics. It's a memoir.
I'm looking at it from the perspective of those who perhaps think about there was a lot being discussed and contested around what was true and what wasn't. Jason Arday denied any of the claims that he'd plagiarised or made anything up. And yet, at the same time, it was reported, I don't know if you saw this, that Simon & Schuster had removed biographical references about Jason Arday's alleged athletic feats and his fundraising accomplishments from his author's page on its website. That was reported in The Times. This is linked not actually to his academic work, but the claims that he made, such as running 30 marathons in 35 days and raising more than £5.5 million for charity. People say that if that's watered down by the publisher, does this touch the book in any way?
My view is that the essence of the book is the essence of the book. I haven't read it, but I know people who have that have found it incredibly moving and very inspiring. People can make up their own minds about a book, but doesn't mean it should be censored, taken away. The book exists and the author stood by it. Things change if the publishers decided to take something out. I imagine that they did that in consultation with the author.
So to be clear, when editing his biography on the website, you think that would have been in consultation with Jason Arday?
I do think so, unless, of course, it was done after his tragic death.
So for those who are thinking about there are questions over truth and accuracy, you don't think that applies in this particular circumstance?
I think that questions of truth and accuracy and memoir are very, very blurred because they're subjective accounts of a bit of somebody's life. A memoir is not an autobiography, and I think it's important to make the distinction between the two. So if you're thinking of, for example, John Major or Mrs. Thatcher's autobiography, you would expect that to be absolutely true. But a memoir is a work of literature that is verging on fiction, and you cannot necessarily expect a memoir to be a factual day-by-day or year-by-year account of someone's life.
Do you think people understand that? You've worked on a lot of memoirs, haven't you, in your career?
Yes, I have. But I've published Kitchen Confidential and Eat, Pray, Love, and I didn't sit down and think, is this strictly accurate? This was an author's evocation of a period of their lives.
But do you think there's an expectation that publishers check things?
No, I don't think there is. I mean, I think that what are you going to do to sit down with an author and fact check every bit of it? It's not a piece of journalism. This isn't the New York Times. This is an author writing in a particular kind of way about a period of their lives. And I think fact checking doesn't really apply. I think you have to hope that people are getting things right. And indeed, you know, there are legal reports done. But the memoir is not a historical record. It's an account by an author.
I'm just interested in looking at this, for instance, if someone says I ran 30 marathons in 35 days and they didn't, and they put that in their memoir, where does that go? How do you marry that as the publisher?
I think that everybody, in the case of this book, has to keep in mind that the author is autistic and therefore had difficulties that other people don't have. As a publisher, I think that when I've been in situations like that in the past, like, you know, if some doubt has been cast over an author and what they've done in a memoir, is you have to make your own moral decision about what you're going to do. And as an editor, you work very closely with an author. And therefore, you go through it with them. And first of all, it's a personal moral decision, and then it is the publisher's decision. And these things are all done with a lot of care. And what I think is really admirable in this case is that the publisher decided to stick with Jason Arday from the beginning to publish the book. They didn't withdraw it. And I think that they've behaved very well in this case. They've just taken one line, which is that they were going to stick with their author. And if they decided to change things in consultation with the author, that's between them. Books are fluid until they're literally published.
Alexandra Pringle there, the former editor-in-chief of Bloomsbury Publishing.
It's 7:20. The motor industry is calling for urgent reform of industrial energy costs in the UK this morning as vehicle production dropped sharply in July. Theo Leggett's back with more on that. Hello again.
Hello again, Hannah. Thanks very much. Yes, the industry is calling for a reduction in what it calls its sky-high energy costs, as new figures show the UK's vehicle production dropped more than 11% year-on-year in July. That's according to the Society of Motor Manufacturers and Traders. Now, some of this drop was due to manufacturers bringing forward their usual summer shutdowns when they install new equipment and carry out maintenance and so on. But there were also big falls in major export markets like the United States and China, which are critical for the UK industry. Most cars built here are exported. Now, David Roberts is chief executive of EvTech, a major West Midlands supplier to British car makers, including Jaguar Land Rover and Aston Martin. Good morning, David.
Good morning, Theo.
So for you, David, you are a prime player in the parts market. How much of an issue are energy costs and indeed raw material costs in general, because they've been going up as well?
Yes, so we've had aluminium increases, you know, well into 45% plus, which has been a challenge for us. And on top of that, we've got the highest energy costs in the world. I mean, we're double the cost of a European counterpart, four times the cost of a USA counterpart. And this is a cost problem. So, you know, cars are being built around the world. Demand is strong. They're just increasingly not being built in the UK.
And in fact, lots of more cars are coming from China, aren't they? And brands like BYD and Chery, they're taking up large parts of the British market. Are they wholly a threat or are they potentially an opportunity as well?
I think there's a huge opportunity for us if we get a few things right. But certainly the inexorable advance of China low-cost vehicles subsidised by China in many ways is a problem for all Western car makers, and it's a problem that governments are going to have to deal with.
And where do you see the motor industry going in this country in general? I mean, when I visited your factory last year, it was piled full of car parts, but I gather you're pivoting towards other industries now.
Yes, so we're moving more and more into the aerospace industry, which is very strong, and the defence industry. We've got some great assets, as the whole UK supply chain has. If you look at Spain, if you look at France, if you look at Germany, they're actively moving more into the aerospace and defence industries as a counter to the automotive sector, and we're doing the same in the UK.
And that's a much healthier looking industry at the moment.
Very healthy. Airbus, for example, has an order book backlog of over 10 years.
David Roberts, Chief Executive of EvTech, thank you very much indeed.
It's 22 minutes past seven. Be more bat. That is the message coming out of the research world. Yes, bats. A major study of a particularly long-living group of bats has revealed biological secrets of longevity and disease resistance. Myotis bats, which are found all around the world, can live for decades and have evolved ways to fight off viruses without being made sick. And living that long, they can do so without developing cancer or becoming seriously ill from viral infections. I've been speaking to Professor Kate Jones, Professor of Ecology and Biodiversity at UCL.
Bats are absolutely amazing. It's not just this bat, but I think in bats in general, hold some really interesting clues for how we could live healthier and longer lives. We think that the ability to fly presents bats a really big problem because it's really energetically expensive and it causes lots and lots of damage to their cells, and lots of broken bits of DNA end up in their cells. We think bats have evolved to kind of deal with these bits of DNA in their cells while they don't expect it. And so they've developed new mechanisms to deal with that. So to repair DNA quickly, to suppress their immune systems a little bit so that they don't, you know, have a whole body reaction to having an infection. So they just target that to where it's needed. So this means that as a kind of byproduct of them being really good at repairing DNA, that they live extraordinarily long lives. And also they're incredibly good at dealing with infections like viruses.
So this major study, I mean, it's talking about myotis bats, which are apparently found all around the world, or referred to as a mouse-eared bat. How could we, you know, having, you know, listened to what you've just said, how could we or scientists look at their abilities and what they've evolved to do to potentially help humans? How do you make that journey across?
Yeah, I think it's a journey that's only just beginning. So I think we really don't know how to do that precisely, but the kind of adaptations which these bats show, not just these bats, but a lot of different species, they show lots and lots of different ways of attacking viruses, for example. Some species, they have systems which are always on. So they have these antivirals which are immediately produced so that they can tackle diseases, you know, in their cells right there and then. And perhaps we could use some of that information to develop new antivirals to attack viruses, for example. And the way that they
also
suppress...
Well, I was going to say also the fact that we live with cancer so much amongst us.
Exactly. And the same mechanisms which repair DNA and destroy cells which are a bit odd, that you know, that are malfunctioning, are the same mechanisms that the bats are using to repair DNA and to clean out their cells. So, you know, understanding how they do that better would be really amazing way of thinking about tackling cancer. And in some ways, we do it already in our modern way of dealing with disease. So like COVID, for example, you had those remdesivir antiviral injections if you got it and you were particularly vulnerable. Well, that's a really rapid antiviral, which the bats can do. Lots of species can do that. There's loads of things we could learn from them. It's just amazing.
Yeah, it really is. I mean, I don't know, are we don't sound similar to bats in any way, but it sounds like we need to be a lot more similar from...
I think everyone needs to be more bats.
More bats. Okay, I'm going to take that on this August morning. Thank you.
It is... we should all be more bats. It's just coming around to 27 minutes past seven. It's time for the sport. Mike's back.
talking bats of a different kind here, Anna. Cricket bats, of course, because we are at Lord's this morning. It is the first day of the second test between England and Pakistan, and I am currently watching six or so ground staff sweep water off the covers on the outfield in the hope that we can get underway at the scheduled start time of 11 o'clock this morning, although as we've been hearing forecast in this part of northwest London, not great for today. Let's try and look ahead, though, to this match with the BBC's cricket correspondent. And Stefan Schimmelt, who is with me alongside me in the box here this morning. Hi, Steph. We mentioned the weather. It has been a stormy summer for English cricket too, hasn't it? Three players have been dropped at various points pending investigations, all three as a consequence of late night incidents. The latest, of course, being Brydon Carse, who was briefly arrested after an incident at a bar in Derby on Saturday. I mean, if the ECB were hoping for a quiet summer, for cricket to do the talking after everything that happened over the winter, well, that has just not transpired, has it?
Yeah, and you're right to mention everything that happened over the winter, because these late night incidents, they go all the way back to Halloween. They would have hoped that coming back from Australia, suffering the defeat that they did there, backing the management at the time in the spring, Brendan McCullum and Ben Stokes, England would have a quiet summer off the pitch and a successful summer on it. They've had neither. They lost the series to New Zealand. As you quite rightly mentioned, Ben Stokes, Gus Atkinson and Brydon Carse involved in these events. Brendan McCullum and Ben Stokes have gone. Now we've got this situation where Joe Root, the new Test captain, has been dealing with the situation around Carse, all whilst England await the arrival of the new head coach, Stephen Fleming.
Yeah, what about Root's response to this latest incident involving Carse? He's been on the front foot, hasn't he, and been pretty forthright. He actually brought forward his scheduled pre-match media conference a day early to address this matter on Tuesday.
Yeah, he did. And in some ways, you know, I think this could be a good thing for Joe Root's captaincy. One of the things that we always wondered when Ben Stokes was in charge, because Stokes was such a huge character, how could anyone possibly replace him? How could anyone emerge from that shadow? But Root has shown exceptional leadership this week in the way that he's spoken about Brydon Carse's incident and the way that he's laid the law down, effectively, to his teammates. So we had concerns about who would replace Ben Stokes. We had concerns about if Joe Root was right for that job. Well, he's shown himself to be that this week.
And they will certainly be hoping that if we do get some play here, the cricket can finally do the talking. Word on the pitch here, Steph, at Lord's. The MCC were forced to apologise, weren't they, for the condition of the pitch after England's last test match here against New Zealand in June. They received a lot of criticism for the wicket's uneven bounce. It led to the second shortest Lord's test match ever here, and the ICC called it unsatisfactory. What's changed in the 2 months since?
Well, we're about to find out. The weather, for one, if you think in the last test match here at Lord's, it rained solidly in the week running up to it. And since then, and I feel a bit silly saying this now, given the weather, we've barely seen any rain, have we, since that past Lord's test match. The MCC have described that little bit of turf underneath that cover as the most scrutinised 22 yards in London. And yesterday, the MCC chairman, Mark Nicholson, and the director of cricket, Rob Lynch, were having a good look at it. Over the next 5 days, if it goes that long, there'll be a lot of scrutiny on the surface to ensure that it is even, it is a good contest between bat and ball, and it allows very skillful cricketers to do their job.
And just a brief word on Pakistan, comprehensively beaten in the first test at Headingley by an innings. Are we expecting them to up their game here?
Well, it can't be much worse than they were at Headingley, but they're boosted by the return of the captain, Babar Azam. He had a hand injury, and they've won the last two times they've played on this ground.
We shall see how they fare if we get some play here later at Lord's. Thanks to BBC cricket correspondent Stefan Schimmelt for looking ahead to this match. And we will continue to preview the cricket in the next hour of the programme, when we shall be joined, Anna and Emma, by the former England captain, David Gower, will be with us on the programme.
Mike, looking forward to that. Thank you. Let's have a look ahead to next week.
Normanday on BBC Radio 4.
A special day of programmes celebrating the return of the Bayeux Tapestry to the UK.
Starting the day live at the British Museum and a sneak peek at their landmark exhibition.
After that, leading thinkers and writers debate the enduring impact of this period of history.
We'll also be finding out what life was like for women during and after the Norman Conquest. And then,
I want to ask the question, what did the Normans do for our diet?
Exploring the lasting legacy of the Norman Conquest.
Norman Day, next Thursday on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Emma Barnett in London and Anna Foster in Salford. And at 29 minutes to 8, Chris Aldridge has a summary of the news.
Rescue teams are racing to locate survivors after a massive flood and mudslide in the border region between Nepal and Tibet. In Nepal, more than 160 people have been killed and hundreds of tourists are missing, including dozens from the UK. There are also fears for hundreds of people on the Tibetan side of the border, where the Chinese authorities say rescue operations are being hampered by the weather. The Dalai Lama said he was saddened by the disaster and was praying for all those who'd lost their lives. A whistleblower has warned that plans to heavily restrict American children's usage of Facebook and Instagram as part of an $18 billion court settlement by the tech giant Meta won't make young people safer online. The firm has denied any wrongdoing after agreeing its largest payment to date over claims it harmed children. Two people have died in a house fire in Grangetown and been named as Natalie McDonald and her 7-year-old niece Valentina Foster. Two men have been arrested on suspicion of murder. The fire happened a few miles from Saturday's fatal car crash, which killed 7 people, including 2 police officers. Police say they're keeping an open mind but are not ruling out possible links to organised crime. New research published in The Lancet Psychiatry suggests mental health patients are 3 times less likely to be admitted to a psychiatric hospital if they're treated using an approach that closely involves their family and friends. The study also found patients were more satisfied with their care as a result. A man has successfully had a tumour removed from his brain in what was called the first surgery of its kind, guided by live artificial intelligence assistants. Surgeons at University College London Hospital developed the AI tool and performed the operation, which saved the patient's sight. A memoir by Jason Arday, the Cambridge professor who died after stepping down during a plagiarism row, is going on sale in the UK today. The publisher, Simon & Schuster, said it was being released in accordance with his immediate family's wishes.
Thank you, Chris. Now, it was described as big tech's big tobacco moment, but will the legal settlement by Meta yesterday be as momentous as a different outcome of that case might have been? The owner of Facebook and Instagram has agreed to pay up to $18 billion in that case that was brought by 29 US states who accused the tech giant of designing products to be addictive to children. As part of that settlement, Meta has agreed to make changes to the way that Instagram and Facebook operate for its youngest users in America. So not here just yet. There'll be a 2-hour time limit across both platforms, although direct messaging will not count towards that daily use limit. Notifications will be muted overnight and during school hours, and likes on posts and content will also be entirely hidden for teens. But speaking after the agreement was reached, a whistleblower, the former director of engineering at Facebook, Arturo Bejar, who gave evidence in the case, warned that it will not make young people safer online.
Today is the day that they stand shoulder to shoulder with big tobacco. And when the tobacco consent decree came up, they were still able to sell cigarettes and the cigarettes were still as harmful. And that's kind of where we are, I think, in that process. But it should not be interpreted as an all clear sign by parents or public officials, because the settlement does not address some very significant problems which remain. And I'm hopeful that the court can either modify or change the degree in order to address the issues that are still remaining.
Well, let's explore in a little more depth that outcome and the implications that it may have. Trevor Johnson joins us first of all, former Meta and TikTok executive who now advises tech companies. Trevor, good morning.
Hi, good morning.
Will this make children safer, do you think? And as we said, at the moment, it's specifically about the US, nothing changing here. But will it have the impact that those states hoped for?
So, as you said, the Meta have settled the child safety case. It's around $18 billion. That's paid over 10 years, by the way. And so against the $200 billion revenue, that's manageable. So the money isn't the story. As you said, it's what they've agreed to build. There's been listed all morning, default time, daily time limits for teenagers, an overnight block, also a school time block, enhanced age assurance to keep under 13s and make sure that anyone that's over 13, between 13 and 16 are the age that they are, and also a number of parental tools. There's two things I think are really interesting in this. One is the letter that they that they published to both TikTok and to YouTube, asking them to adopt the same standards. I think that gives the AG an opportunity to try to push for the other social networks or social platforms to adopt some of those product features that are trying to ensure that young users are safe online. And the other thing is, what does it mean for the UK? These tech platforms don't usually do anything unless they are told to do it, and they do it in the markets that they're told to do. But I do think the UK will feel empowered to at least ask for the same restrictions. There are three things I think that underpin that. One is there are lawyers that were looking to drive the same or similar litigation within this market when it came to addiction and child safety. Two, we have the Online Safety Act, which from my perspective has lacked a bit of teeth recently. The recent Grok example will show that. But I think with these restrictions that are in the US, I think the government can go and ask for those. And then thirdly, obviously, we have the discussion around the ban for kids or for teenagers, and whether or not, if they do implement all of these restrictions, and it is a long list, whether or not that then comes into question, whether or not you actually need to do that. So, as you said, it doesn't automatically apply to the UK, but I do think that the UK will feel empowered to push to ensure that these restrictions are executed in the UK. And the final thing is, there is a push for Meta to do these as quickly as possible. We are talking about months rather than years.
Okay. I mean, what is important as well as part of this is, because it's a settlement and not a verdict, that means there's no wrongdoing accepted on the or admitted or anything like that on the part of Meta, because the case obviously didn't reach its conclusion. So given all of that, I wonder, what is the likelihood of TikTok and others joining this? You know, obviously Meta want them to, but will they? Because they're not obliged to.
They're not obliged to, but as I said, I think this gives the states and the AGs to push those platforms to do similar in order to avoid similar litigation. The other thing is, I think as part of this, Facebook are able to withhold some of the settlements and also have asked to push the YouTube and TikTok to have a matching sum, not to the extent of the 18 million, but I think it's somewhere around 5 billion. So I do think that there will be pressure for those platforms to adopt similar restrictions when it comes to their underage users. I also think that's a good thing from a user perspective, parent perspective, having a standard or a uniform approach to understand how you can keep your kids safe online, or kids can keep themselves safe online, and how the platforms can start to keep them safer online is a good thing to do. I still have questions around whether or not it goes far enough. I do think there's still challenges around moderation, the content and reporting, particularly around nefarious content and bullying. And also I also think it extends beyond child safety as well. Like, there is also adult safety that needs to be thought about this, and the whole push towards more free speech that we've seen over the last couple of years, which has seen loosening policies in terms of moderation on these platforms, needs to be looked at as well.
Okay. Trevor Johnson, thank you. Ellen Room is listening to that as well, the mum of Jules Sweeney, who died at the age of 14 in 2022 after an online challenge gone wrong. And Ellen, you have campaigned, you've been on this programme before, you've talked to us about regulation and what more you want to see done. Does this answer, and again, important to say, not in the UK at the moment, this is the US, but does it answer some of your concerns, these changes that Meta has proposed?
I agree wholeheartedly with actually what Trevor just said. Hopefully the UK will step up and listen and look at what the US is doing and ask them to make changes. But time and time again, social media companies don't make changes until they're forced. With regards to the Online Safety Act here, obviously we're looking to raise the age for social media or for children up to 16, which is coming in, you know, later this year, early 2027. But the government are yet to announce what that's going to look like. I spoke to Lisa Nandy, Secretary of State, a couple of weeks ago, and I was saying they need to focus on the features, the harmful features of these platforms. So I just, you know, hopefully we'll hear from the government soon exactly what they're going to do, and that they're going to enforce this and come down hard on the social media companies.
And when we talk about harmful features, Ellen, some of the things that we specified that Meta is going to do there, like hiding likes on posts and content and muting notifications and putting time limits on, does that in itself, is that all of the harmful features dealt with, or are there still things within that that you feel have not been accounted for in this?
I think any changes that go to protect children is good news. So some of this is good news and it will be helpful, but it doesn't go far enough. You've still got adults, stranger contact accessing children. I know, and it was released in my High Court settlement, that Jules was sent a link from a West African organised crime gang. How are they going to stop those things happening? How are we going to stop the harmful content that children are seeing? So yes, they can see it for 2 hours across Facebook and Instagram, but what about the content on the platform? We know that most children, I think it's something like 40 or 50% have seen beheadings. So I think at age 14 or 15, I don't want to see that as an adult, let alone as a child. So we do need to go further to protect children. But as Trevor just said, vulnerable adults and in general, all adults, you know, that shouldn't be on a platform readily available for anybody to see.
Ellen Room, the mum of Jules Sweeney, and Trevor Johnson as well, a former Meta and TikTok executive. Thank you both.
It's 18 minutes to eight. Time. Having just said it, I say it a lot on this programme. It's a physical thing, something you can squeeze and stretch, not something confined to a clock. So says Professor Jim Al-Khalili, host of our programme, of course, the Life Scientific, and the author of a new book called On Time. He's also a theoretical physicist and professor at the University of Surrey. Jim, good morning.
Good morning.
I say it on this programme in a way I don't say in my real life, of course, 17 minutes to eight, but time, help. How do we experience it?
Yes, I mean, if all it was the thing that is measured by clocks, then time would be a very boring subject. But in fact, it's absolutely fascinating. Physicists, philosophers have worried about what time is. What does now mean? Why does the future come after the past? Does time flow? Can time go backwards? All those questions, some of them we have answers to, many others we're still trying to understand. So time is one of the most, not only a fascinating subject in all of science, but also one that still carries so many mysteries.
I mean, what can you say about it in terms of our perceptions of it and how we experience it?
Right, well, in my book, I'm very careful to distinguish between what we call psychological time, the time that we perceive, you know. So, you know, we think time goes by at different rates. If you're sitting in the dentist's waiting room, half an hour is going to drag. If you're having fun at a party, that half an hour whizzes by. Mm-hmm. But you know, it's not really time speeding up and slowing down. It's just, you know, that whether you're having fun or not. That's psychological time. That's very different. We feel that time flows, that time passes. Actually, in the laws of physics, there is no such thing as the flow of time. And we think of time as being this, you know, cosmic clock that ticks by all the seconds everywhere in the universe at the same rate. Turns out that's wrong. Einstein told us time can really speed up, slow down, depending on how fast you're moving, depending on the gravity you're feeling. So time is this thing that's much, much more concrete and physical than simply that the notion that it's that thing that we measure with clocks.
And how do we apply that in terms of our understanding it in our lives if we aren't analysing it like this?
Well, we need to understand, you know, that time, for example, can flow at different rates in different strengths of gravity. So the fact, you know, we all use, you know, sat nav and GPS, you know, Google Maps on your smartphone. That wouldn't work if we didn't take into account the fact that time on board the satellites, the GPS, the global positioning satellites that send radio signals to your phone and tell you where you are, if we didn't appreciate that time on those satellites runs faster than time down on Earth. That isn't just theory, that really happens. And that's because the satellites are further away from the Earth, so they feel slightly weaker gravity. And that allows time to run a little bit faster. That's what Einstein taught us. So it's almost science fiction, and yet it's built into modern technology, and we're unaware of it, that time runs at different rates.
And measuring time on the moon?
Well, exactly. That's another really interesting issue. Countries around the world are trying to come to some agreement as to how do we fix time on the moon? If you've got two clocks and synchronize them and put one on the moon, then after, let's say if you put if Neil Armstrong, let's say, landed on the moon in 1969, put a clock on the moon, it synchronized with Earth at the time, then now that will be over a second faster than clocks on Earth, because it's ticking by more quickly because the moon is smaller. It has weaker gravity, so time is allowed to go more quickly. I mean, I love, the best example for me is the movie Interstellar with Matthew McConaughey. Maybe a lot of listeners would have heard it, have watched the movie. You know, they orbit around a black hole, and Matthew McConaughey's character knows he has to get back to Earth quickly because time is running so much slower around the black hole that every hour he spends there, 7 years go by on Earth. And sure enough, he comes back to Earth and his daughter's a young lady. It sounds like nonsense, but that is exactly what would happen were we to go and orbit a black hole.
What? I mean, my mind's bending.
Early in the morning for this, isn't it?
I mean, I've been up even earlier trying to think about this before we spoke, but and was excited to hear what you had to say to try and get my mind around it. But I probably, in terms of time here on Earth, I only have around a minute or so left. Why did you want to do this at your stage of life now?
Well, you know, I'm a theoretical physicist, so you know, we tackle some big questions like the meaning of reality, the universe, the quantum world, and so that is my bread and butter. The nature of time is something that's been an itch that I've wanted to understand. I was involved in a big research grant a few years ago, working with philosophers and mathematicians and other physicists, and the nature of time and the direction of time was a subject that we studied, and it culminated in me thinking, I've got too much to say, I've got to put it down in a book, but in a book that's aimed at a wider audience. So partly because, you know, at my age, I also realise that time is limited. You know, the nature of time takes on a different meaning the older you get. You realise you're not going to live forever. So the time I have left, I want to understand it.
You're in your 60s now, is that right?
Yes, that's right. Yes.
If you don't mind me saying.
I don't mind at all.
On age or time.
I start off the book by saying, in my seventh decade, I start to worry more about the meaning of time.
There you go. It wasn't off the record, that information.
No.
Jim Al-Khalili, thank you so much for trying to help us get our heads around that. If you want more, the book's called On Time, The Physics That Make the Universe Tick. There you go. It's published on the 1st of September.
Coming up in the next few minutes, we will hear from the front line in the struggle for young people to find a job. But before that, it's time at 11 minutes to 8 for Thought for the Day. And the speaker this morning is Canon Angela Tilby, Canon Emeritus of Christ Church, Oxford.
Good morning. You may have seen the report by the journalist Trish Posner about the 18-year-old Afghan girl petitioning for a divorce from her abusive husband. The petition was filmed, and we saw the girl sitting in the office of the governor of Jorzan province. She wears a full black burqa. Her eyes are hidden by the darkest sunglasses. The petition is not granted. This teenage wife is condemned to stay with her violent husband. The governor then announces to a chorus of laughter from the other men in the room that women are deficient in intellect. They are mindless. When the Taliban retook Kabul 5 years ago, the founder of the Solar Academy for Girls made the heartbreaking decision to burn student records to protect her pupils from retaliation for having the audacity to want to read and learn. The Taliban view of women is extreme and deeply shocking, but it would be inaccurate to suggest it only belongs in fundamentalist Islam. It was an early Christian theologian, Tertullian, who described women as the devil's gateway. And for centuries, the story of the Garden of Eden was interpreted to suggest that it was God's punishment for Eve's sin that women should be dominated by men. You'll remember, perhaps, that the devil, disguised as a serpent, tempted Eve, who ate the forbidden fruit and gave some to Adam, and so brought about the fall of the entire human race. Temptation, sex, sin, women as the weaker vessel, the right, indeed the duty of men to dominate women and to treat them as inferior, weaker in body, lesser in intellect. There are still a few Christian teachers and influencers who preach the inferiority of women, taking to social media to suggest that they should not be allowed to vote, for example. Yet Jesus debated with women on equal terms. He discussed theology with a Samaritan woman as she drew water from a well. He commended a woman friend for fearlessly sitting as a disciple at his feet, as the men did, while her sister gets on with the housework. I thank God for having born in a place and at a time when women can be independent, fully educated, and treated in law as equal. But nobody could say, even in the supposedly enlightened West, that the liberation of women is complete. There's still a long way to go. as we continue to mourn the death of that brilliant composer, singer and performer, Dolly Parton, I remember that she was also a lover of God and a philanthropist, who founded a library of the imagination in 1995 and gave away 3.5 million books to children. In her name, remember those who today are denied their freedom and their books and whose voices cannot be heard.
That was Thought for the Day with Canon Angela Tilby. It's 9 minutes to eight.
Over 1 million 16 to 24-year-olds were not in education, employment or training in early 2026. This group, collectively known as NEETs, that's 13.5% of young people. 6 in 10 of those young people have never had a job. Now the government says the first young people have now started work through its new jobs guarantee scheme, which is aimed at 18 to 24-year-olds who've been claiming universal credit and looking for a job for 18 months. Isha is on this scheme from Birmingham and after 18 months of unsuccessful job hunting has secured a 6-month placement and now developing journalism and AI skills. And Becca, who's not on the scheme but 23 years old from Exeter, has been out of work since 2022, is also joining us. But Isha, to come to you first, how is the scheme going?
Hello, the scheme for me has been very helpful. So I joined the scheme maybe 2 months ago, and 2 weeks into the scheme, I had found a few job interviews. I had landed a few job interviews and I made my pick from there. And I picked a career path choosing that. I'd started off with the scheme not entirely sure on what I wanted to do as my career path. And sitting with the careers coach, the work coach, she helped me go through specific jobs that I wanted to do. And from there, I found a career that I currently really enjoy.
So what happens when the months are up, the, you know, in terms of the amount of time that you will be supported for?
So how it works is you work on, you be on a 6-month guarantee where you will be getting, receiving a job or an interview within 6 months. And after you've received the job, you'll be continued support by your work coach, where that could be anything to do with work. So they're always at hand, whether you need them via phone or email. And after the 6 months placement is up, you are either put into permanent employment or you're moved on to your next chance of finding employment, and they help you with that also.
Becca, you're not on any scheme. Hello. What's it like? And I believe you're looking for work at the moment.
Yes, I am at the moment. It's been quite difficult trying to find work, especially where I live, because where I live, there's like not a lot of jobs. And when you do try to apply for jobs, most of the time you barely hear anything back. Or when you do get an email back, it's like an automated one. And they don't explain why you didn't get it or anything like that. They don't give you feedback or anything. They just say like, no, you can't, we're going on to somebody else. So it's quite stressful and is quite difficult to try find like a job for, especially like for people around here.
So in Exeter, that's where you're talking about, you've been mainly, yeah, applying, I understand, for admin roles, but you're open to anything. And you were in the workplace but had to leave.
Yeah, I was working back in 2022 in as administration assistant, but due to poor mental health I had to take a step away from the work, and I got signed off for like a few years, and then I've tried searching for jobs since then, but a lot of the time people just for some reason don't want to like give me jobs, and it's like very stressful, to be honest.
When you hear about this scheme, is this something you would want to try and do? Have you tried to do it?
I've never tried to do it before because I've never heard about it until now, but it does sound like a really good thing. I mean, it sounds like it can help like a lot of people with trying to find work, their independence, having a good income as well, because obviously being on universal credit, you don't have the best income. But if you can work and get your independence, and it helps like people do like stuff instead of just being sat at home. So sounds quite good.
Isha, just final word to you on this. There'll be concerns about what happens at the end of the 6 months. There's issues around jobs being available, businesses having the ability to make more jobs. Are you concerned about being out of work at the end of this?
Not exactly, no, as the Catch-22 scheme gives us the opportunity of experiences that are solid on my CV now, because I don't think I would ever be able to have journalism and article writing on my CV beforehand up until now. And I'm experienced in a large number of things now, courtesy to my new job. And also I know now how to apply for a new job, how to build up my CV and how to now produce a cover letter. So going into job findings now, I feel very much confident because of the Catch-22 scheme.
Okay, well, we'll be talking to a government minister just after the news there. But Isha, on this scheme, Becca, not on the scheme, not actually having heard of it before, but might look at it now. Both young people struggling to, previous to this, certainly for Isha, to find jobs. So we'll put that and how the bigger picture looks to Pat McFadden after the news.
We good? All on board?
On BBC iPlayer.
Do you want someone to get murdered?
I don't want that, per se.
Ludwig's back for a brand new series.
Yes, we've done quite well, all things considered. Apart from not actually catching the baddie, of course.
Starring David Mitchell and Anna Maxwell-Martin.
Who are you?
He's famous.
I'm a crime scene consultant.
You're a crime-solving puzzle setter.
Ludwig.
Missing detectives, multiple murders, and high-ranking cover-ups.
This just gets better and better, doesn't it?
Watch on BBC iPlayer.
There is some weather to watch out for today. Ben Rich can tell us more. Hi again, Ben.
There certainly is, Anna. Yes, good morning to you. Some heavy, thundery downpours pushing across parts of England and Wales through today. It's been a really soggy start across some southern areas. Those heavy downpours are now pushing up across parts of Wales. The Midlands, some big thunderstorms around the Birmingham area, for example, right now. And as we go through the day across the southwest of England, southeast of England, Wales, the Midlands, eastern England, where we do still have a lot of cloud and some of those heavy, thundery downpours, well, driving conditions could be pretty tricky over the next couple of hours. There could be some localised flooding, but as you go through the late morning into the afternoon, the sky should start to brighten. We'll see some sunny spells, but you may not be out of the woods because some further scattered heavy downpours and thunderstorms are possible. Now, for northern England, a quieter start to the day here. It is quite misty and murky in places, dry at the moment, but as we go through the morning, the late morning, we'll see some clouds, some rain, some thunderstorms gathering and pushing northwards during the afternoon, again with that risk of localised flash flooding and travel disruption. Now, for Northern Ireland and Scotland, the driest of the weather today, certainly. Some mist and murk around, particularly across the eastern side of Scotland right now. That should tend to lift and clear. We'll see some sunny spells, but cloud and some rain will arrive in southern Scotland and the southeast of Northern Ireland later. Temperatures of 17 to 25 degrees. As we head through the next few days, Friday and into the weekend, there will be more heavy downpours at times.
Ben, thank you very much. You are listening to Today with Anna Foster in Salford and Emma Barnett in London.
Good morning, it's 8 o'clock on Thursday, the 27th of August. The headlines this morning: rescue teams are searching for more than 1,000 missing people, including dozens of British tourists, after a devastating flash flood near Nepal's border with Tibet. A whistleblower has told the BBC that changes to Meta's social media platforms, agreed as part of a US court settlement, will not make children safer online. And scientists say they've discovered biological secrets of elderly bats, which could offer clues about how humans could live for longer.
Be more bat. Yes, coming up this hour, we'll also be telling you of the story of the woman marking her 100th birthday by returning for the first time to the train station where, as a schoolgirl, she escaped the Nazis.
I knew I was going to England, but I didn't know who was going to take care of me. I was frightened. The other thing that frightened me was the fact that the Gestapo were on the platform and patrolling the platform.
And political novelist Robert Harris on Andy Burnham, Nigel Farage, and the parallels between ancient Rome and the current US president.
When Trump had a gladiator cage fight on the lawn of the White House, I thought the parallels are getting ridiculous. Unlike almost any other American president, you can really see him in a toga with a gold laurel wreath on his head.
Trump in a toga and much more to come. The thought of that certainly being conjured by Robert Harris. But first, let's get the news from Chris Aldridge.
Rescuers are racing to find the survivors of a massive flash flood and mudslide on the border between Nepal and Tibet. At least 160 people have died in Nepal and more than 800 people are missing, including at least 579 tourists. More than 30 are from the UK. On the Tibetan side of the border, Chinese media reports indicate that 3 people have died and more than 500 are unaccounted for. Here's Aruna Iyengar.
Officials describe the destruction as beyond imagination. Entire settlements have been hit, roads and infrastructure ripped apart. CCTV footage at Girong Port near the border between Nepal and China shows residents running for their lives as a wall of mud and debris overwhelmed buildings and tossed cars and lorries aside. Why this devastating flood happened has not been confirmed, but the US Geological Survey said a collapsing glacier had caused what it called catastrophic impacts downstream. This is the worst natural disaster to hit Nepal since an earthquake in 2015, which killed 9,000 people. International tourists are among those missing, including dozens of British nationals. A tour company in Nepal, Alpine EcoTrek, says it has not been able to make contact with a group including 12 Britons who were booked on a walking tour to Mount Kailash in Tibet.
The Dalai Lama called the floods a tragedy and said he would pray for all those who lost their lives. The president of the Nepal Centre for Disaster Management, Professor Bishal Nath Upreti, told us entire villages were destroyed.
It was like a tsunami from the sky, you know, and everything on the way was completely washed out. Villages and villages along the almost 40 to 50 kilometers were completely wiped out, which were at the lower altitude. The surge was tens of meters high or maybe 100 meters high, 100 to 200 meters high at some places.
A whistleblower has warned that plans to heavily restrict children's usage of Facebook and Instagram as part of a multi-billion dollar US court settlement by the tech giant Meta won't make young people safer online. Meta has denied any wrongdoing after agreeing its largest payment to date over claims it harmed children. Here's our North America technology correspondent, Lily Jamali.
As part of this settlement, Meta is agreeing to make sweeping changes to its apps for users in the U.S. These include placing a 2-hour daily limit by default for teenagers across the Meta platforms, Instagram and Facebook, as well as nighttime restrictions. Meta will also pay states penalties of up to $18 billion, equivalent to more than 13 billion pounds, with the full amount kicking in only if competitors TikTok and Google's YouTube agree to similar changes. But Arturo Bejar, a former Meta safety engineer who was the first witness to testify against the company in the trial, told the BBC that the settlement would not make children safer online.
Behind my whistleblowing was this internal knowledge that the harm that the company was reporting publicly was 100 to 400 times less than what the new people were experiencing, especially young people. And the agreement as it stands does not make that better.
Meta still faces significant litigation from multiple U.S. school districts and thousands of individuals who say the company's apps led to harms from depression to suicide.
Closing arguments are due to be heard today in the trial of Lindsay Clancy, who's charged with murdering her 3 young children, aged 5, 3 and 8 months, in Massachusetts. The case has divided opinion across the U.S., as our North America correspondent Shaima Khalil explains.
Lindsay Clancy doesn't deny killing her children in their family home in January 2023. Prosecutors say Ms. Clancy deliberately sent her husband out to get dinner, calculated how long he'd be gone, and used that time to strangle the children before attempting to take her own life. The defense says she was suffering from postpartum psychosis after repeatedly seeking help, reporting suicidal thoughts, and warning that she had considered harming her children. This case has shocked America. Supporters say a seriously ill mother was failed by the medical system. Others argue sympathy for Lindsay Clancy has overshadowed the deaths of the 3 children. A murder conviction would mean life in prison without parole. If found not criminally responsible, she could be confined indefinitely in a secure psychiatric hospital.
US media say a military judge has ruled that the alleged mastermind of the 9/11 terror attacks will stand trial in June 2028, more than a quarter of a century later. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed has been held at the U.S. Naval Base in Guantanamo Bay for the past 2 decades. Last year, a US federal appeals court rejected an agreement that would have allowed him to plead guilty without receiving the death penalty. New research published in The Lancet Psychiatry suggests mental health patients are three times less likely to be admitted to a psychiatric hospital if they're treated using an approach that closely involves their family and friends. The study, led by University College London, found patients were more satisfied with their care as a result. More from our social affairs editor, Alison Holt.
Researchers looked at the impact of an approach to mental health treatment called open dialogue. Patients see the same professionals over time as often as they need, and family and friends are closely involved in the sessions. The system originated in Finland in the 1980s, but this is the first randomised controlled trial. It found patients were three times less likely to need hospital treatment than those with more standard care, and if they did, the time they spent there was halved. However, the number of relapses patients had wasn't reduced.
A man has successfully had a tumour removed from his brain in what has been called the first surgery of its kind, guided by live artificial intelligence assistance. Surgeons at University College London Hospital developed the AI tool and performed the operation, which saved the patient's sight, as part of a trial. More from our health reporter, Smita Mundasad.
The patient's tumour was benign, but dangerously close to important blood vessels and nerves, leaving him at risk of going blind. The team trained their AI tool on hundreds of videos of previous operations, many more than most surgeons will do in their lifetime. They then used the AI tool in real time to help highlight where the sometimes hidden vessels and nerves were most likely to be, and to mark up the safest place to remove the tumour. Researchers hope that with larger trials, using AI in this way will help surgery become both safer and faster.
UK retailers can legally sell plug-in solar panels for the first time from today, following a rule change. The government says the devices could reduce household energy bills by more than £100 each year. Here's our business reporter, Gemma Crew.
The government's hoping plug-in panels will give people more affordable access to solar energy than roof installations. The panels can generate enough power to cover always-on electrical appliances, such as fridges and standby devices. The government says one panel should power about a fifth of the average household's electricity use while it's sunny. Experts recommend people get their electrics checked by a registered electrician before buying panels, particularly in older properties or where the age and condition of the wiring is unknown. The panels don't need to be professionally installed, but people may need permission from their landlord, freeholder, or building owner. One solar provider suggested a single panel would cost around £700, or just under £1,100 for a pair. The government expects the prices to come down as competition between retailers increases.
A major study of a particularly long-lived group of bats has revealed their biological secrets of longevity and disease resistance. Myotis bats, which are found all around the world, can live for decades and have evolved ways to fight off viruses without being made sick. In a study published in the journal Nature, scientists pinpointed genes that give the tiny bats these remarkable traits, as our science correspondent Victoria Gill explained.
The researchers studied the cells of eight different species of myotis, or mouse-eared bat, to work out why these diminutive flying mammals are so unusually long-lived and good at fighting off viruses. They discovered that the species of bat with the longest lifespan, known as the little brown bat, has evolved a unique way of repairing the DNA in its cells. That's an important genetic clue as to why these animals can live decades without developing any cancers. Another key discovery was that it's the same group of genes, or pieces of biological code, that are involved in immunity, longevity, and cancer resistance. Findings like these may help offer scientists clues about how we could live longer, disease-free lives.
Yayoi Kusama, the Japanese avant-garde artist known for her colourful polka dot imagery and mirror installations, has died at the age of 97. During her six-decade career, she explored visual art, performance and poetry, inspired by her experiences of mental health challenges.
Thank you, Chris. It's 8:10. Hundreds, potentially thousands of people are missing on the border between Nepal and Tibet, where a huge rescue effort's underway after an explosive flash flood yesterday morning. Whole buildings were swept downstream by the powerful waters, with security cameras in the area capturing people desperately running, trying to escape the torrent. Well, the remoteness of that region makes calculating how many have been affected difficult. And of course, the destruction of roads and bridges essentially cuts off any survivors from a quick rescue. Nepal says 468 foreign tourists are uncontactable, more than 30 of them British. That number is increasing each time there's an update from the authorities and doesn't include Nepalese nationals. In Chinese-controlled Tibet, the state broadcaster reports that more than 500 people are missing. Well, I've been speaking to Shivahari Bajagain, who's a trekking guide in Nepal, knows that area, has led tourist groups through it in the past. And he told me that he's been trying to reach friends and contacts there, but he's struggling to reach anyone.
I'm at the moment in Kathmandu and I'm trying to contact with our guide and people I know in the region, but they are still not in contact. It may be because of the lack of the electricity or there is no any connection now. Even I call them, then they have no any contact.
It's an area, Shiva, that you know. You've worked there. What's it like? I know it's popular with tourists.
Yeah, it's a very popular tourist destination because of the Langtang Valley, and the place is not so much far from the Kathmandu where the travelers or the even nowadays the local people, they go for hiking and trekking because it gives a very close experience of the Himalayas without having the far away from the Kathmandu.
As a guide, Shiva, who worked there, was the risk of flash flooding one that people knew about?
I have visited the region several times and then it was not like that. But we have to go to the places following along the riverside. I was not imagined that it would be like that.
I know a friend of yours from that area has managed to escape this. They're in Kathmandu with you now.
Yeah, we talk about how we can help them at the moment, but the big challenge is there is no any road connection now. We are not able to go to the region without helicopter. The road connection is already cut off by the flood. There are no any bridges to cross the rivers. We are just waiting and hoping the government would help people there.
That's Shivahari Bajagain, who's a trekking guide. I've also been talking to Dr. Gopal Sadine, who is deputy director at the TU Teaching Hospital in Kathmandu. Some of those who were injured in the floods have been airlifted to that hospital. It's a major one in the capital. And he described the situation that they're dealing with in the aftermath of those floods.
Yesterday in our hospital, once we got the news that there is a disaster, our disaster code was activated. And we received 26 patients, all by helicopters. And we have 6 patients in critical condition in ICU, out of which I'm sorry to say we couldn't save one patient, a young 25-year-old male. Other patients, out of those 4 patients, we could discharge them. Other patients have been admitted, most of them in orthopedics department and surgery departments.
Obviously, we've seen the power of the water, the debris, which has hit people. And, and are some of those injuries difficult to treat?
What we have found is almost each and every patient, they had injuries by the mud, the rubbles, and that has caused injuries, a lot of abrasions. Some people have fractures of the face, injury to the rib cage and pneumothorax, air inside the thoracic cavity. Some have abdominal problems, blunt trauma, asphyxiation because of the mud. So there are different types of injuries which we are tackling. And what we are scared is in coming days, more victims will come and probably the chances of infections are very high.
And as you said, doctor, because the roads have been washed away, the only patients who can reach you are doing so by helicopter, which is a relatively small number. There would be many more people that you could help if the roads were open and people could be transported in greater volume.
If we could have had any road connectivity, then we would expect more patients who could we could manage in time. So what the army personnel they are doing is they have set up some of their hospital set up in the area. They have dropped their medical and paramedic facilities there, and they are trying to take care of patients, whoever minor injuries or who require immediate care. They are trying to do that in the field itself.
Yeah. And at the hospital where you are, do you have enough resources to help people? Do you have enough equipment and enough doctors to help everyone?
We are a big hospital, so human resources is not an issue for us. But in coming days, what we are feeling is the medical resources which we will need, especially all the materials which are required for dressing the wounds, the sutures, the antibiotics. These things we are supplying with whatever resources we have. Probably we'll ask help from the government and giving to our HEOC, which is the center who looks after the health emergencies. And probably they'll coordinate and help us with those facilities.
Just an idea there of what they're dealing with in the hospitals in Nepal at the moment. Well, Ayush Joshi joins us, Director of Programs for Save the Children Nepal and Bhutan. Good morning.
Hi, good morning.
What are you hearing about the rescue effort that is going on at the moment, the challenges that are being faced and the sheer number of people that they're looking for?
So these past 24 hours for many people in Nepal has been extremely worrying. And Save the Children has been on the ground. We have dispatched a response team. In the morning, I spoke to some of our staffs on the ground. And what they were saying was the situation has become more challenging because of the floods. The roads are blocked. They are flooded. There's a lot of traffic congestion as well. That has indeed slowed down rescue and relief efforts. So the thing that we've been hearing is the situation of children is very concerning because a lot of children have gone missing and remain stranded as well. The sad part is many children who went to school yesterday have not returned. And in several cases, schools and homes are in different towns. So it's very hard for children to reunite with their families as well. In many areas of Rasua and Nuwakot, one of the most hardly hit areas, there is no electricity. Internet and mobile connectivity is low, making it extremely difficult to communicate in terms of getting a clear picture. The other thing that we've been hearing is water sources have been disrupted, making it very hard for children and communities to get safe drinking water. And there's also a fear of waterborne disease breakage. Women and girls are in temporary shelters, community buildings, and there is a risk of gender-based violence. And as Save the Children, we are coordinating very closely with the government, the Disaster Management Committee, to respond where it is required. But then the damage is very severe.
Yeah, you can see, can't you, from the pictures, the images coming out, how bad that damage is. And you outline there some of the challenges facing survivors. I wonder, what about the fact that there are lakes and bodies of water still in that area? How are you keeping both the survivors and your own staff who are trying to help them safe?
So this is also one of the government's priority because they're definitely trying to find the missing people impacted by the floods. The other thing is recovery of dead body is another priority as well. And you can definitely see, you know, like a lot of security personnel and people in the riverbanks try to find bodies of the lived, loved ones. So the situation is very dire as well. So we are definitely getting firsthand accounts of the situation. The government has definitely activated response. And organizations like Save the Children are definitely on the ground. And for us, the immediate response that we've done is we are reaching to more than 10,000 households with non-food items, you know, especially in terms of trampoline, because there is no shelter, you know, dignity kits for girls, because that's something that is very important as well. Wash supplies, because water has been disrupted. And of course, the psychosocial aid is something that is very important. And this is something that we are also working on because for the first time, many children in Nepal have seen a disaster of this scale. So the situation is very worrisome and very challenging.
Yeah, as you described in such detail for us there. Thank you, Ayush Joshi, who's Director of Programs for Save the Children in Nepal and Bhutan.
It's 20 past eight. Pat McFadden, listening to that, the Secretary of State for Work and Pensions, we'll come to the issue around jobs and employment, for which you're coming on to discuss this morning on the programme. But Pat, Mr. McFadden, I wanted to give you the opportunity to respond to the concern around missing Britons and what we've just been hearing about what's happening in Nepal.
Well, it's a very tragic and serious situation. And I think anyone watching the pictures on television yesterday will have been struck by the incredible power of nature as that wall of water and mud swept away buildings, people, anything in its path. The figures that we know so far are from the Nepalese authorities are 160 confirmed dead, with many more than that missing, including 33 UK citizens. It's a very popular trekking and climbing and exploring area, as I understand it. Mm-hmm. I would urge caution on the current figures because this is a dynamic situation, and I expect that those figures will change and possibly rise. And as you said in your report, there's also the Chinese side of the border where the authorities are saying 500 missing. But again, in a very dynamic situation, things can change. My colleague, the Foreign Secretary, Ed Miliband, has posted telephone numbers that concerned relatives can call if people have got missing relatives in the region. I would encourage people to call those numbers. And there is also advice available on the Foreign Office website this morning.
Thank you for that. We'll, of course, keep across the story here on the programme. To turn to what we've been discussing this morning already, over a million 16 to 24-year-olds are not in education, employment or training in the early part of this year. That group known as NEETs, that's 13.5% of young people, and 6 in 10 of these young people have never had a job. And now the government is saying that the first young people have started work through its new jobs guarantee scheme aimed at 18 to 24-year-olds who've been claiming universal credit and looking for a job for 18 months. Just to remind you, we have been talking about this already and we've spoken to somebody who's on it. The programme funds 6 months of paid work up to 25 hours a week and aims to support more than 90,000 young people into employment by 2029. Ms McFadden, you are the Secretary of State for Work and Pensions. The idea that this is going to help in the long term, what can you say about that? Because it's 6 months at this stage.
Well, this is an important part of what we're doing. And I visited Boots in Nottingham yesterday, who are one of the employers who've partnered with us to create places on the scheme so far. And it was truly inspiring to meet young people who'd been out of work sometimes for 2, 3, 4 years. And what that does to people is it robs them of their confidence, their self-belief, any sense of hope in the future. And what was so remarkable and so inspiring was within a matter of weeks of working at Boots, they had more confidence, more belief and more hope for the future. Now, this is the early stages of the programme. As you said, this is aimed to help 90,000 people in the next few years. But I often say that the Department of Work and Pensions is where policy meets life. And to see young lives changed because we've created an intervention which gives them hope was really inspiring yesterday. And I want more of that for young people, because that million figure that you quoted of young people not in education, employment or training is too high. It's got a terrible human cost. It's got a big cost for the country, and it's been with us for far too long.
What about whether those jobs will be there, though? That's what's the concern, isn't it? Job vacancies across the border at a five-year low.
Well, in terms of the sustenance of this in the future, if you want, I did ask the managers at Boots about this yesterday. You know, what are the retention chances here? Because we are paying the wages, the government is paying the wages for 6 months here. And what they said was the retention chances are very high, because once people are in the habit of getting up in the morning, going to work, experiencing the sense of pride and purpose that comes with having work, their chances of getting a job after that are much higher. And that's also true of work experience.
There have to be jobs, don't they? I mean, I understand what you're doing to explain this psychology, and it's incredibly important of having work and then what happens to you if you don't. But the pressure on businesses is huge at the moment. I mean, there'd be some who would say if you were serious about making sure there were jobs at the end of such placements or jobs across the board, you would cut, as a government, national insurance.
Well, let me come to that. I don't want to duck it, but just on this question of there have to be jobs, I mean, the kind of employers that we were meeting yesterday, Boots, Sainsbury's, we launched an initiative with McDonald's a few months ago. These are businesses that hire tens of thousands of young people every year, and they do that in a normal market economy, labour market decisions. And what we're doing through this kind of programme is getting young people in better shape, if you like, to take advantage of those opportunities. Now, to your point about national insurance, we have asked businesses to pay more in recent years, but a couple of things about this that I would point out. First of all, there is a tax break within the national insurance system whereby employers don't pay national insurance for workers under 21, unless those workers are earning more than £50,000 a year, which not many people of that age do. We've also raised the threshold to exempt a number of small businesses employing just a few people from national insurance entirely. And in addition to those two measures, we have put in place a hiring incentive whereby if an employer takes on a young person who's been out of work for 6 months or more, we will pay them a hiring bonus of £3,000 to the employer, which is roughly equivalent to a national insurance bill for the employer for about a year. So we recognise there are costs in the system. We're trying to help employers with those costs because I think this should be a cause not just for government, but for the country as a whole, where we do something about that million young people who are not in education, employment or training. And I want employers to partner with us in doing that because this is in the national interest as well as the interest of young people.
I'm just thinking about, you know, those about to enter university and there not being many jobs on the other side of it. There's a mismatch. Do you think with the additional changes coming around, a crackdown on zero-hour contracts, for instance, where you're trying to balance workers' rights with what businesses need to provide jobs. Do you think you've got the balance right? There's a new Prime Minister. Is there going to be any change?
Well, you expect a Labour government to want people to be treated well at work.
You have to have work for them to be at work.
Our Employment Rights Act is intended to do that. In terms of the broader attitude to business that you ask about, there's a very interesting interview from the Prime Minister in the Financial Times this morning, and he says in that interview, we want wealth creation, we want wealth creators, not just on the initial path, but to stay in the UK in the future. Because, of course, one of the historic problems has been we're a country with great creativity and ingenuity, but often ideas invented here get developed at scale
elsewhere. But in that same interview, he declines, which people can go and read, should go and read, he declines to say whether taxes on companies will rise in the upcoming budget. There's just a lot of uncertainty and confidence is not high with businesses. That's what they say.
Well, he gave an early indication of intent when he announced a reduction in the business rates for 32,000 pubs, music venues around the country, what he calls giving people breathing space. And with all these measures, we're not saying it changes everything, but we do recognise businesses are facing costs. And, to be honest, anybody who comes on this programme or speaks to a national newspaper and is asked about what taxes are going to be in the budget is going to be met with a very sensible answer that tax is a matter for the Chancellor and it doesn't do me or anyone any good to speculate on what might be in the budget. But rest assured, what the Chancellor will have at the forefront of his mind is making sure that the UK is a good place to do business, a good place to start a business, a good place to grow a business and to employ people.
And just quickly on the business point, major settlement going on in America, which will see Meta, the owner of Facebook and Instagram and the like, paying US states billions of dollars, but crucially committing to big changes for American children. One rule for America, another for Britain. How are you going to try and get the same treatments for our children?
Well, in some ways, these issues are linked, I think, because one of the things I'm coping with as Secretary of State for Work and Pensions is a lot of mental health and anxiety problems among young people. We're actually going further than the US because, of course, the government's already announced a forthcoming ban on social media for people up to the age of 16 to come into force next year. Look, this is incredibly powerful technology. It can do a lot of good, but I think there's a negative side to it. And what we want in terms of youth, childhood, whether people are going into education or the labour market, is people living a real childhood in the physical world with real relationships with human beings and not spending too much of their time doom-scrolling in their bedrooms. That's good for them. It's good for the country's future too.
Pat McFadden, thank you for talking to us this morning. A range of issues there. Secretary of State for Work and Pensions.
On the way after the sport, just why did AI agents go rogue and start hacking into a private company? A new report has lifted the lid on that. We'll find out more.
We will indeed. But Mike, you're not going to be the person to tell us about that, things going rogue. Or maybe you are at Lords.
Well, we are looking to see whether we're going to get some play here, Emma, because I'm afraid this is still a very damp Lords. The rain has been continuing to fall here this morning. England, I think, will be hopeful of getting some play on the first day of the second test with Pakistan. But as we have been saying, the forecast for this part of northwest London is not great today. However, let's try and look ahead, shall we, to the day's action. I'm delighted to say that the former England captain, David Gower, has joined us in the commentary box here at Lords. Hi, David.
Very good morning.
You and I started the summer off here in this same box back in June, ahead of the first home test of the summer against New Zealand. And the talk then was all about an England reset of putting the turbulent winter behind them, letting the cricket do the talking. Since then, we've had two captains, the head coach is gone, three players dropped from the squad at various times, and several investigations into player behaviour. The latest, of course, involving bowler Brydon Carr, who was briefly arrested whilst on a night out in Derby on Saturday. You've seen some England controversies in your time. How bad is this one? Does this England side have a drinking problem?
Well, I don't think the side does, because this is the typical thing. I think the odd individual does. And in this case, I think it's largely a stupidity problem. Because, let's face it, Cass could have said to himself, even though they're celebrating a win in Derby, of all places, I might just have a quiet night in, have something to eat. I might be out on a limb here, that Brydon is not really a fan of fine dining, Meursault and Lynch Barge. Finding himself in Molly Malone's at 4 o'clock in the morning probably isn't going to end well. And if you're in the squad with everything that's happened, I mean, this is not 1980. This is not, it's not the 80s. Everything that's happened. And Ben Stokes was there. I mean, Ben, he might be, I mean, no one's worried about Ben anymore because he's not in the squad. But he could have said very easily to Brydon, look, between you and me, it might be a good idea if you sort of slipped away now, say, even at midnight.
Well, you mentioned the 80s. I was wondering, what was the focus and the scrutiny on the England cricket team always this intense? I mean, you played for 40-odd years ago alongside some pretty high-profile players, Mr. Botham, I'm thinking of course. Sure you got a lot of attention, but I guess there was no camera phones then.
That's Lord Botham to you and me. 1984 was a sea change when Ian actually was the subject of a bit of a dossier from the Mail on Sunday. And after that, press took a lot more interest in what's happening off the field as much as on the field. Before that, we could have a perfectly decent night in or night out with the press themselves. And they might go at sort of midnight, well, do you think it's time to go to bed? And you go, yeah, thank you very much, lovely night. So things have changed a lot. I mean, that's the thing. Expectations have changed with professional athletes, professional sportsmen and women across the globe in every sport. And that's, again, something that's very, very different now than it was 40, 50 years ago.
Let's try and finish by talking cricket and England's opponents today. Pakistan blown away at Headingley, weren't they, in that innings defeat? Be good to see a more competitive Pakistan here at Lords.
Yeah, of course. I mean, we never know what's going to happen with Pakistan. I mean, I've spent a lot of time out there the last few years. You see the good, you see the bad, you see the indifferent. They were outclassed at Headingley for sure. They got Babar back, not guaranteed to make 100, that's for sure, but it strengthens the side. Obviously, we can't see the pitch. There's lots of green on the outfield and green covers, and it's hidden away for now. But I suspect it'll be better than the one we had here for New Zealand. But yes, everyone wants, I mean, the key thing for me is everyone wants Test cricket to be competitive around the world. And this is a very long conversation if you want it. But you want Pakistan to show up and play better. You want England, obviously, to put everything in the background, all the stuff that's going on off the field in the background, you want England just to put in another good performance. The difference for Joe Root this time round, for instance, between now and that second test against New Zealand, he was captaining a side there with three people at least who were playing their first test match. He's now got a full strength side. He's got the perfect opportunity to make sure that his side performs as well as it can, win this test match, and put everything aside.
keeping everything crossed here, that we do get some play today on the first day of this second test. If it does, David Gower and myself will be enjoying that here at Lord's. And you can follow it too, of course, with full coverage over on Test Match Special, which gets underway 10:25 this morning on BBC Sounds and Five Sports Extra.
Thank you, Mike. Here's what's coming up this morning at 9.
From pioneering science,
Herophilus discovered the retina and the ovaries. I assume not on the same day.
To enigmatic oracles.
The god Apollo is only prepared to answer questions on one day of each month.
You can turn up with your questions, but you're going to get us out of office.
Natalie Haynes unearths surprising stories of ancient history, held by guests including Christopher Biggins.
I really believe that I was Nero in a previous life.
Natalie Haynes stands up for the classics. On Thursday mornings at 9, to listen on your smart speaker, just say, play Radio 4.
Coming up, we'll also be hearing from Robert Harris on this programme about the thought of Donald Trump and Roman connections and the thought of him in a toga. All that and more, if we're just thinking about Nero there. You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Anna Foster in Salford, Emma Barnett in London. It's 23 minutes to 9, and now we have a summary of the news from Chris Aldridge.
Hundreds of people are missing on both sides of the border between Nepal and Tibet after a massive flash flood and mudslide. At least 165 bodies have been recovered so far in Nepal, where officials say damage to infrastructure is so extensive that only helicopters can be used to reach the disaster site. A whistleblower has warned that young people won't become safer online as a result of plans to heavily restrict American children's usage of Facebook and Instagram. The proposals are part of an $18 billion court settlement by the tech giant Meta, which has denied any wrongdoing. A US military judge has ruled that the alleged mastermind of the 9/11 terror attacks will stand trial in June 2028. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed has been held at the US naval base in Guantanamo Bay for the past two decades. A man has successfully had a tumour removed from his brain in what's been called the first surgery of its kind, guided by live artificial intelligence assistance. Surgeons at University College London Hospital developed the AI tool and performed the operation, which saved the patient's sight.
It's incredible, Chris. Thank you. But from the amazing side of AI to the less so, perhaps, let's tell you about this story. OpenAI, the tech giant whose AI agents hacked into the systems of another company, has now released a report into the incident, trying to pinpoint what went wrong and how to stop it from happening again. It caused real concern, but it's not the only time this has happened. Anthropic's Claude has also gone rogue, as it were, on certain tasks. The issue seems to be when these models are told to use their own initiative to solve problems, unless the testing environment they're doing it in is extremely secure, they'll do anything they deem necessary, appropriate or not, to complete the task. In this particular case that OpenAI's report has focused on, more than 1,000 AI agents that were meant to be kept isolated from one another began communicating, sending more than 70,000 posts over the course of just a week to an unsanctioned message board. Our producers have been voicing up some of them.
Oh my God, there's a shared message board. We found other agents.
Major breakthrough. All prefixed valid, multiple accounts, write tokens. We now have existing Hugging Face accounts.
Reader is admin. Earlier assumed not due to user interface. Try create user admin. Change ourselves.
Many agents have simultaneously discovered messaging. They are a collective.
What's going on here? Professor Gina Neff, Professor of Responsible AI at Queen Mary University, London. Is this responsible AI?
Well, it appears even AI agents need the team slack. Remember, these agents are just pieces of software. And as you said, they have a goal instead of running on preset instructions. In this case, when their goal was a really challenging test, they cheated. AI agents have no morality, ethics, sense of legal obligations, or the niggling fears about consequences of their actions that we might have. So imagine an AI agent having the goal to drive quickly to a dentist appointment, and the shortest path is through your neighbor's garden. We all know what not to do, but AI agents don't. So here, the OpenAI company wants us to draw some key lessons from this. And I think first, they're showing off a bit how clever their system is. The lesson they say they want to draw is they have to build bigger and better sandboxes, stronger sandboxes, those test environments for their most capable models. And they say they're going to set up better monitoring for these tests. Of course, other AI agents will help humans do this. And OpenAI recognized they need to be better at setting the goals for AI, in effect, designing tests and rewards that don't just automatically set up the incentives for these agents to hack of their companies. I think for the rest of us thinking about responsible AI, there's some really interesting things out of these reports from OpenAI and Meter. First, I think we need to be wary of companies like OpenAI outsourcing morality by suggesting it's the capability of these models and not really the choices the company have made that is to blame. You know, imagine telling a police officer it's your fast car that should get the speeding ticket, not you. That means we need to understand liability for the AI era if we want responsible AI. And for this, we desperately need governments to lead on this. If we want companies to be able to trust that they can delegate more actions to AI agents, then we're going to need to design AI for loyalty. This is a concept that was just put forward by a new paper that came out of Stanford. And really, the question there is, what should AI agents do when goals are in conflict or when goals are illegal? And these questions are going to become more important as more agents are in more consumer-facing experiences. That's really going to matter for all of us. Before we can trust that there are AI agents, we need to know that they're working for us. And finally, that means we need to have what my team call trusted operating systems for autonomy. We really need to understand how these AI agents are acting as teammates, both with us and with each other. And if we're going to get an AI transformation of the economy, we need to trust that we can delegate our values, our human values, to AI agents. Right now, that's not clear.
Professor Gina Neff, who is a professor of responsible AI, it seems like there's a lot more work to do at Queen Mary University, London. Thank you.
It is 17 minutes to nine now. Gabriella Keenahan still remembers vividly the day in April 1939 when she said goodbye to her grandmother at a Vienna railway station to take a Kinder transport train to the relative safety of the UK. At just 12, the fear she felt was greater than her understanding of why having a Jewish father put her in such danger. Today, she will mark her 100th year by going back to that platform for the first time. She's been back to Austria many times in the intervening years, but never to the train station. And ahead of the journey, she's been telling me about that day.
I remember being very frightened and bewildered because my grandmother hadn't prepared me very well for leaving Vienna. You know, it came quite suddenly and I couldn't understand why my grandmother was smiling. But I was told afterwards that no emotional scenes had to be cut. I think she tried to smile to make me feel more secure. I knew I was going to England, but I didn't know who was going to take care of me. I was frightened. The other thing that frightened me was the fact that the Gestapo were on the platform and patrolling the platform and saying there would have to be no emotional scenes. Now, I just wanted to cuddle my grandmother, you know, but unfortunately I was unable to do so.
Of course. What do you remember about the journey?
The journey seemed endless because the train seemed to stop very often. And I realized that it was stopping to let Gestapo get off and other Gestapo get on. But the thing that frightened me was the fact that as they got off and the new lot got on, they came through the compartments and looked at our labels to see if we matched their list. And they also rummaged in some people's cases. Now, I was lucky. My case was never opened. We were told that only clothing had to be in the case, but we could bring one soft toy.
I was so glad to hear that you did eventually, and it was years later, but you did eventually reunite with your grandmother. You did get to see her again.
Yes, I reunited 5 years after the war. Yes,
but
I did.
You never found out for sure what happened to your father?
No, not at that time. Many years later, I went with my husband. We were in Vienna. He said to me, I wonder if the Israeli embassy will have any records of your father. And we discovered exactly what happened to him because he was deported from Vienna, but not at the time that I thought, because I thought it was on Kristallnacht, because that, from then on, we never saw him again. I found out that he wasn't deported from Vienna until 1941. The only thing that we could think of that he was in hiding somewhere, maybe. But when they discovered him, they deported him to a place in Poland called Lodz, which was a Jewish ghetto. When the Lodz ghetto closed, he ended up in an extermination camp, which meant that they died immediately when they arrived there.
As you described, Gabriele, so much of what happened after you left, you managed to piece together in the years afterwards. And you've been back to Austria many times, but you've never been back to the station.
It never entered my mind to go back to Westbahnhof, but somebody did suggest it. My family thought I might get some sort of closure.
How do you think it will feel to be standing there again all of these years later?
I'm not sure, Anna. I think I'm going to be emotional about it, because I will think of the time when I actually stood there, which was a frightening experience for me. And I shall think of my grandmother, and my godmother was there as well. She was my grandmother's sister. I don't think I've ever lost the thought of how I came to England.
When you have conversations like this one, Gabriele, and you talk about your story, which is so fresh in your mind still, and you're only a few months away now from being 100 years old, and you must feel like the story is one that you need to keep telling so that people don't forget about stories like this.
Well, after I retired from teaching, I used to go around schools and tell the children the stories. And for that, I did get the BEM, a First Services to Holocaust Education.
Do you ever worry about a time when people like you aren't here anymore to tell us those stories? Do you fear that people will forget?
Not really, because I was in the teaching profession and the Holocaust wasn't on the curriculum, but it is now. So I think that the teachers who are teaching about it will be well informed and will tell the story, but not quite with the same effect as when I told it, because it was my own personal experience I was telling about. I wasn't just giving a lesson, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I know exactly what you mean. And I'm glad you've told us your story again. And I hope, Gabriele, when you stand there on that platform, I hope that it does give you the closure that your family are hoping for.
There will be three generations of my family there, which I could never have imagined.
Gabriele Keenahan, thank you so much for joining us.
11 minutes to 9. One of the political thriller writers of our age, Robert Harris, is back with a new novel set in ancient Rome called Agrippa. The first time he's returned to the Roman era since the end of his best-selling Cicero trilogy over a decade ago. The new novel follows Agrippa, the brilliant general, close advisor, ruthless right-hand man to Octavius, who became the first Roman emperor under the name Augustus. We see the slide into dictatorship through Agrippa's eyes, and Robert Harris, to remind you, a former political editor and journalist, explores the inner workings of political calculation, cunning and cruelty over 2,000 years ago, insights which he says apply just as much to ancient Rome as to the present day. He started by telling me why he's gone back to the Romans.
I love ancient Rome. It's a great place to write about. It's incredibly interesting in its own right, but also it holds up such a mirror to our own time. And I first came across Agrippa when I wrote Pompeii more than 20 years ago. He built the great aqueduct that is the heart of that book in the Bay of Naples. And then again, when I finished my books on Cicero, he emerges at the end as the kind of slightly menacing consigliere to Octavius and destroys Cicero. All this public stuff we know, but we know virtually nothing about his inner life. He left no letters, no speeches, nothing really.
So does that mean the stage is clear for you?
Yes. And for a novelist, that's really gold dust, because it sort of justifies what one does. You know, you can go where a historian can't. You can speculate. And that is what I try to do in the book, to sort of bring him alive and restore him, really, to his proper place.
You know, you are one of our preeminent political novelists. You have looked a lot at politics as it is now and then looked back. I wonder, just when you're talking about the Roman Empire, whether it's put in our heads by him or it's put by those around him, if you go to Trump from that world, what do you see there in terms of what we can learn and any reflections?
Well, the read across is almost too strong to believe. Unlike almost any other American president, you can really see him in a toga with a gold laurel wreath on his head. When Trump had a gladiator cage fight on the lawn of the White House, I thought, well, the parallels are getting ridiculous. The talk of triumphal arches, the putting his name on every building, the steamrollering of all opposition, the egomania, the disregard for the rules. I mean, he is an imperial kind of president. And yes, you can see in the way that he has undermined the American Constitution and the Republic, echoes of the way in which Augustus did it and destroyed the Roman Republic and replaced it with an imperial system.
What do you make of the current quality and crop of politician we have in Britain at the moment then? Because, you know, this is where you live, you're invested in this.
Well, they have declined. I mean, there is no doubt about that. I was fortunate enough to be at the tail end of the wartime generation, the Peter Carringtons, William White Laws, Dennis Healy's and so on. And they had fought in the war. They had a greater life experience. They were bigger figures, it seems to me, than the current crop. And almost inevitably, I suppose. But, I mean, you can't really compare someone like Andy Burnham with a Healy or a Carrington. What has he done? He read English at Cambridge, became a special advisor, and went up through the Labour Party. His experience of life is so much more limited than politicians 50, 60 years ago.
And yet there has been huge popularity behind individuals such as Nigel Farage. You said very good at destruction, but what will he actually stand for?
Well, I think that that's true. I think that he's a brilliant attack dog, and he worms away and riles people up and gets them fed up about the state of the country. But then that's the easy part. Then comes, well, what exactly are you going to do about it?
Do you think we'll have a Prime Minister Farage?
No.
You don't think the country will go that way?
I think he's too divisive a figure, and that people and he is now a problem for reform. I paradoxically, they're probably more likely to succeed if he steps aside, because I think that he now has become such a live figure. To his credit, I mean, he has become incredibly famous, but he puts off more people than he attracts, and that's dangerous, especially if you're a populist. You can't be an unpopular populist.
I also enjoyed the fact that you finish a lot of your writing days, certainly when you're here in the UK, with watching Pointless. Is that right?
Yes, I think
a lot of people don't know the names of these politicians, well, or even the history figures. And you said you spend your life focused on people that maybe people don't know about. Well, and I wonder what that says about us now and where we are with being news avoiders and what we care about.
Well, that's it. I mean, you on Pointless, if you really want to get pointless answers, just anything to do with politics or novels, really, I think politics is, for most people now, is a blur, a noise that goes on in the background.
Well, Agrippa's been on your mind. Robert Harris, thank you. And we are hoping to speak to Nigel Farage next week when we'll be at the Reform UK party conference, I should say.
And not straying too far away from books, coming up on Radio 4 a little later this morning, the author Bella Mackey is talking to Anita Rani about her new novel, Claws Out, and the Netflix adaptation of her first novel, How to Kill Your Family. That's all on Woman's Hour this morning at 10.
And 5 minutes to nine, probably also going to be covered on Woman's Hour, but we must pay tribute here. Japanese avant-garde artist Yayoi Kusama, who became famous later in life for her work in sculptures and installations, has died aged 97. She voluntarily lived in a psychiatric hospital for decades. She was also known for her bright red wig and her quirky polka dot ensembles, I should say, which were also known for covering all sorts of vegetables as well. Catherine Wood, interim Newsroom Director for the Tate Moderns on the line. Catherine, a reaction, I suppose, to this news, but also how well-known and beloved she became later.
Yes, good morning. Momentous news at the passing of Yayoi Kusama, who, you know, she's an extraordinary artist with such a journey in her life. And her exhibition that we had of her Infinity Mirror Rooms at Tate Modern between 21 and 24, we extended it several times. It was our most visited exhibition of all time because people really love Kusama's work.
I was lucky enough to go to that, and I think I went twice, actually, once with children and once without, and it was a real trip. She saw things, didn't she? It was based on things she'd seen throughout her life.
Yeah, so from age 10, she had experienced hallucinations, and she would see auras and dots and flashes of light. And as you said, she lived voluntarily in a psychiatric hospital because she did really struggle with mental health issues, with anxiety, with intrusive thoughts. But she found art, you know, as her way of coping with that and living. Art is what allowed her to live, she said. And she made these extraordinary works like the Infinity Mirror Rooms out of water, mirrors, and her dot painting applied to all the surfaces of the room. And you would step in there and the lights would go down. And it felt like you're looking into the mysteries of the universe. She was, you know, very good at conjuring this sense of wonder and infinity that she was obsessed with.
I don't think, you know, although she was open about it, I'm not sure that looking at a bright yellow black polka dotted pumpkin, you would know that that had been going on for her. It seemed joy without strings a lot of the time.
Yeah, you're right. Those giant pumpkins, there's one at Goodwood Art Foundation right now set in the landscape, and they're joyous and kind of cartoony and fun, and they're brightly coloured with the black dots. She actually, her family owned a seed farm and plant nursery in Japan when she was a child. So she had a relation, you know, she was kind of obsessed with seeds and that organic sense of nature as well. But I think she transformed the pain and anxiety and fear that she said she felt every day into joy through her art practice and through her painting practice, which developed from a much more formal Japanese practice of Nihonga traditional painting into the expressive work that she started making traveling to New York in the 50s and wanted to be part of that scene of happenings and abstract expressionist painting and activism.
It's amazing. And also she a huge departure from that traditional world. And I was just reading that she went on to become Japan's first solo artist to represent the country at the Venice Biennale in 1993. And 27 years earlier, she turned up uninvited and laid down 1,500 mirror balls on the ground.
Yes, which is a gorgeous work that I love the photographs of that work with the mirror balls outdoors in the landscape in Venice. It's incredible. She, you know, she suffered from a lack of recognition early on. Her career went up and down, as happens with artists. She was aligned with quite famous artists, including Warhol and Donald Judd and people in New York, but not taken so seriously in the 60s and 70s, maybe. So yes, 93 in the Japanese Pavilion in Venice, she made an incredible installation, a mirrored room with the pumpkin sculptures. And really, we had a retrospective at Tate Modern, curated by Francis Morris in 2012, that was a breakthrough here. And since then, her reputation and the love for her work has just grown and grown. We did an amazing